It's showtime.
Go head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. Here we go. We have made it to Thorn in the Side Thursday for this 18th day of June 2020. We are well past the halfway mark of June. The summer is flying past. The summer solstice is imminent, but you wouldn't know it if you were here in almost level West Bicol Trump Virginia stand. Another day of rain and nothing but rain in the forecast as far as the, if not the eye, the radar can see. I think I'm getting a little bit stir-crazy again. The older I get, the more I seem to be affected by seasonal affective disorder syndrome or whatever it's called. I gotta have some sunshine in my life. And there just hasn't been any for, well, I guess since Sunday. And it's the fact that why am I talking about the weather? Stop that, Bob. Stop it, Bob. Yeah, but it is Thorn in the Side Thursday. We got lots of thorns this evening, but we're also going to have a little. We will ameliorate the thorns in the beginning of the second hour as our good friend Dan Fisher will be joining us to talk about, a lot of stuff. And it'll probably be highly substantive, and I think you'll find it quite interesting. I hesitate to say entertaining, because there's the issues with which we are all dealing these days are not in the least bit entertaining, but it will be compelling and it will be interesting, and I hope it will be engaging. So that's coming up in the next hour. Every program here at the Horn begins with gratitude, because you are the ones who keep it going. You're the ones who make it possible. Being as how we don't have anybody underwriting us in exchange for us telling you to buy more, buy gold now, you know, buy high and sell low. That's how this hustle works. You need to buy gold now, but gold is your best hedge against inflation. Nope, neither that nor steel buildings nor wooden flooring culled from the rapidly disappearing forests of Southeast Asia. No. No wavy radios or mattresses picking up, vacuum cleaners picking up bowling balls off Swedish mattresses. None of that bullshit. No super beats. No uber arugula. No. Just your determination to keep independent broadcasting alive and kicking. And so we begin this evening, this Thursday evening, trying to finish off fundraising for this past Tuesday. We got $90 to go on that, and after that, $400 yesterday and today. So the fundraising goal is at $490, and I hope some of those 1 in 100 people who listen to this program will kick in on it, because I don't like those Friday on the Front Porch community made miracles. It's not that I don't like them; they're necessary sometimes, but it's nice if we could have a little bit of the stress and the pressure off. That all having been said, thank you very kindly to our subscribers for this 18th day of the month. Our anonymous friend, whose note I read yesterday evening, is among those, as is Stephen and Grace. Thank you both, all three of you, very, very kindly. Thank you for being partial sponsors of this program and helping to make it possible for us to move toward year 17 of independent, liberal, progressive broadcasting. Thank you so very much indeed. Ralphs is looking forward to hearing from Dan. Good, good. Thank you. Yay for Dan, says Ralphs. And a $25 challenge in honor of Dan's appearance here this evening. So thank you, Ralphs. There's 25 bucks that's just itching to turn your 25 into 50. So if anybody wants to do that, that'd be a big help, and it would take us down to only 40 bucks to go to finish Tuesday's fundraising. Thank you, Ralphs. It's out there, and it's waiting. And it's just waiting for whomever you decide to be. So I think that's most of the housekeeping. Of course, we'll have Friday on the front porch tomorrow, and we'll have rain tomorrow. And we'll have rain Saturday and rain Sunday and rain Monday and rain Tuesday and rain Wednesday and rain Thursday. A week from Friday, there is a chance of the sun appearing over the hills and hollers of Almost Level West by Cold Trump Virginia, Stan. A week from Friday. And then it's back to more thunderstorms. Summer will have begun by then. Frustrating. Frustrating. I mean, I got a new propane propane burner that I could be using to start my work on my ramen broth, but no. We'll get there. Well, thank you, Jeremy. Jeremy in Vermont has just answered 10 of the $25 challenge from Ralphs, so there's only 15 bucks left to go in that. That's wonderful. Thank you, Jeremy. There's a bunch of different directions in which we could go in this first hour of the program until Dan Dan joins us. the ongoing complaints from the whiny toddler in chief continue. He gave a sit-down interview to the Wall Street Journal. I guess he perceives them to be at least a little bit friendly yet. And without even being asked about it, he brings up the business of the ramp at West Point. You know, it's a good idea not to do that. Let the thing just be consumed by the 15 millisecond news cycle, and it'll go on by, and people won't even remember it anymore. But no, he had to bring it up again. Probably because the Lincoln Project has just blistered him with it, and there's no way he hasn't seen it. So, without even being asked a question, he said, "So I'm going to go real easy." So I did. And then the last 10 feet, I ran down. No, he didn't. They always stop it just before I ran. They always stop it. Yeah, they thought I was crazy with the strawberries, but I fooled them. I've got with the ice cream. And so I spent 3 hours between speeches and saluting people, and they end up, all they talk about is ramp. If you would have seen this ramp, it was like an ice skating rink. So I'm the only one that can happen. Hello, 25th Amendment. How are you today? Oh, yeah, I understand. Just being neglected, being ignored like you have been for the last 3 years when you're so eager to get out and do your job. Yeah.
He was like an ice skating rink.
Curiously, the general walking next to him didn't seem to be having any problem with the ice skating rink. Yeah, well.
I mean, here I spent 3 hours on stage, the sun pouring in, and I saluted 1,106 cadets, and that's not easy. Even the general said, "That's amazing. Other presidents would never have been able to do it, because usually they do the first 10. They do 10 honor rolls, and then they go home. I stayed there for hours, and what do? I get publicity about walking down a ramp. And does he have Parkinson's? I don't think so."
I don't think so either. I mean, if it makes you feel any better, Mr. President, and I use the term loosely, I don't think you have Parkinson's. I think you have tertiary neurosyphilis from your sexual Vietnam in the 1990s. And, of course, it doesn't help that history has a memory. History is memory. And there's video evidence of Joe Biden walking down the same or similar ramp with no problem whatsoever. But then again, Joe Biden wasn't wearing elevator shoes. He didn't have lifts in his heels. That's why he stands at that, the viral Vespasian does it, that weird forward cant angle. But he said all kinds of crazy shit in that Wall Street Journal interview. Among other things, nobody knew, according to him, nobody knew what Juneteenth was until Trump came along. No, really. During the interview, he said, I did something good. I made Juneteenth very famous. It's actually an important event, an important time, but nobody had ever heard of it. And, of course, we all know by now the way this works, that when he says nobody had ever heard of something, it means that he had never heard of something. Yeah, right.
Nobody ever heard of Juneteenth.
Nobody. Not even the African American community and voting rights community and the civil rights community that celebrates it, you know, every year. They'd never heard of it. They were just they had this urge to celebrate something that they it's like why the salmon swim upstream to spawn. They'd never heard of spawning, but they go upstream anyway, and because it's just something that's hardwired into, and that's how it is with Juneteenth. Sure. We're having some cognitive dissonance early on in the program this evening. Steve in New York says, no. He did not say that nobody had ever heard of Juneteenth. No, I refuse. I just refuse to believe it. I wonder if Frederick Douglass told him about it. Very likely. But sorry, Steve. He said it.
Nobody knew anything. Nobody ever heard of Juneteenth. I made it very famous.
And you know, Trump, says Darlene in Connecticut, wanted to grab onto the arm of that general for support walking down that ramp so badly, and the general didn't reach out to help the MFer either, LOL. That was my impression, as someone that has trouble with ramps myself. But I have a damned good reason why. Yes, you do, Darlene. You've got a diagnosed reason why, and that's part, I don't mean you are, but generally speaking, that's part of the problem here. Everybody can see there's something desperately wrong with this man, and nobody will have the common decency to diagnose him, because nobody is allowed to say in his weird realm that the emperor has no clothing. Actually, says Flavio, a black Secret Service agent told him about Juneteenth. Are you funning, or is that some sort of somehow factual? I don't know, Flavio. Sometimes you got to help out with that kind of thing. Yeah. One of the things that I suspect Dan and I will be talking about here in an hour or so is the decision by HBO to pull Gone with the Wind from its rotation and just kind of put it away in a vault somewhere. And when I When I saw that news, I thought back to something before the lockdown started. Maybe back in February or March, early March. I'm not sure when. Late February, early March. I think that narrows it down pretty well. I remember coming on air, I think it was a Monday, and talking about how Turner Classic Movies had run Gone with the Wind that weekend, and how Agnes and I sat and watched it because neither of us had seen it in a very long time, and just how gobsmacked I was by the disgusting degree of racism. And it's not just here or there. I mean, it's salted all over the movie. And I remember saying, in fact, that the only decent characters in the movie, the only unabashedly good characters, are the black characters. All the white folks are nasty to one degree or another. Evil, vile, grasping, hateful, greedy, violent, misogynistic. You might want to check out the archive. Stop telling us what to check out in the archive, Bob. Okay, I get it. Stop telling us you get it, Bob. That's too preemptive. Stop telling us this. But at any rate, I offered some commentary then that seems a little bit ahead of its time. And we'll talk to, I'll talk with Dan about that in our conversation. But it led me to, there are so many of these odd little Jungian synchronicities that occur on this program and have occurred over the years. Oh, okay, Flavio, that was a real thing. From The Guardian, Trump was told meaning of Juneteenth by Black Secret Service agent report. I'll be darned. So at least one person had heard of it before Trump made it famous. Thanks, Flavia. Thanks for the clarification. Anyway, there are a lot of those little moments that happen here. And as I told you, we spent Saturday working on clearing out the studio. We're nowhere near done, and it would be nice to have a few sunny days to get it done in. That's part of my yearning for sunshine. Because things kind of have to be able to be carted out of here and sit outside while we clean and rearrange and all of that. And that can't happen as long as it's constant, as long as we're in monsoon season here. But anyway, I think I mentioned that I found some little treasures when we got into a closet we hadn't been able to open for a while. And my parents, back in, I guess, the fall of 1981, had wrapped up a lot of glassware and put it in a couple of boxes. And they had used copies, old copies. They weren't old then. They were just laying around copies of the Florence Times Tri-Cities Daily. And I unwrapped one piece of glassware just to see what it was. And I couldn't resist reading the newspaper that it was wrapped in. Because this is like some sort of, It's like a sort of domestic household archaeology, a record of the times that you never expected to see. And so, lo and behold, it is the newspaper from Sunday morning, September the 6th, 1981. I had been a high school graduate for all of 3 months on that day. And I was beginning my first semester of my freshman year, the first time living away from home in far Missouri. And without me underfoot, and with my grandmother fairly well sedentary, and not as far deep into her descent into dementia as she would later go, I could imagine my parents pulling all that glassware together and carefully wrapping each and every piece with old newspaper or laying around newspaper. And so for one of the glasses, they used page A1 of the Florence Times Tri-Cities Daily, serving the people of the Shoals. 102 pages, 10 sections, 50 cents. Forecast called for generally fair through Labor Day, with light easterly winds. Highs Sunday and Monday in the mid-80s, with lows in the mid-60s. The previous day, University of Alabama had thumped LSU 24-7. Bear Bryant was still coach. Georgia blanked Tennessee 44-0. The rising tide of the Miami Hurricanes beat Florida 21-20. It's all just a snapshot. And so the above the fold banner headline for Sunday morning, September 6, 1981, Reagan will seek stronger Israeli ties. He was not quite 8 months into his first term. But what got my attention was what I saw when I turned over that piece of old newsprint. In Tuscumbia, Klansmen group for conference. It had been a little more than a year since Ronald Reagan, whom Republicans still insist on deifying and worshiping, even the never-Trump Republicans or the people who are now independent because they can't stand to share a party with Donald Trump because Donald Trump is so awful. Well, they still maintain their cult membership in the Church of St. Ronnie of Reagan, that greasy-headed old B-movie actor who began most of the social and cultural destruction that this society continues to suffer unto this day. It would be, for instance, another 5 years before Reagan and his cronies and the people who enabled him and aided and abetted him, including Democrats, got together to decide that my generation needed a proper fucking. That we needed to work a considerable bit longer before we could have the Social Security that previous generations were collecting at 62 and 65. Not us. Oh, no. Hell no. But that was just a twinkle in the great communicator's eye back then in September 1981. And like I said, it had been just a little over a year since Reagan appeared at the Neshoba County, Mississippi fairgrounds in Philadelphia, Mississippi, and gave a speech upholding states' rights. in the very county where three young voting rights and civil rights activists, Cheney, Schwarmer, and Goodwin, were lynched by the Klan and their bodies dumped in 1963, the year of my birth, in the banks of an earthen dam. Well, that was a giant dog whistle to every white supremacist, every Klansman, every bigot in the United States of America. That August 1980 speech. And so by a year later, the Klansmen were having, openly and notoriously, as the legal phrase goes, a conference in Tuscumbia, Alabama. A man named Bill Caton, a staff writer for the Times Tri-Cities Daily, wrote the article. He begins it with a quote from one of the filthy Klansmen. "You all want to be the best our race can produce." That's what a speaker at a national Ku Klux Klan leadership conference told some 35 to 40 Klansmen Saturday. The Klansmen came to the multipurpose center in Tuscumbia from as far away as Texas and California to hear 2 days of speeches, make national Klan policy and decisions, and attend a rally and witness a wedding. Saturday, Klansmen heard several talks by prominent Klan leaders, including the ironically named Don Black. Black said he hoped that the conference would promote unity among the different sects of the Klan across the nation. He said that the Klan plans to become more involved in local government and later to have a powerful voice in national affairs. And 38 years later, they would have a son of one of their own in the White House. He said, during the meeting, one spokesman told the Klansmen they are the cutting edge of the knife. He said Klansmen must be willing to fight for their ideals. Calling the United States decadent, he said that the Klan can't sit around waiting for something to happen. It must begin to strive for its goal. That goal, according to the spokesman, is white supremacy. And the paper is torn there, but it continues in the next column, picking up. This is sort of like how you find fragments of old books of the Bible in places like Qumran and Nag Hammadi, and there's just a word here and a word there, and you kind of got to guess. But it's not hard to guess, because the next column begins with a continuation of a quote, "with mixed racial shows on television and in the movies." Mixed racial shows. Now again, don't pat yourself on the back. Stop telling us not to pat ourselves on the back, Bob. Don't pat yourselves on the back thinking that this was just a bunch of cracker-ass rednecks from Alabama. Again, they came from California. They came from Texas. They came from Alabama, Mississippi, Tennessee, Georgia, Florida, North and South Carolina, Arkansas. Quoting the Bible, the speaker called for Klan unity. Because they are, after all, were and still are, the Christian Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. He told members they could not wait for God to do their work for them, that they must take their own action. Following the speech, all the Klansmen raised their right hands, palms open, and shouted, "White power!" They then adjourned the meeting for a lunch of fried chicken and potato salad. Yeah. The multipurpose center was decorated in Klan symbols and U.S. and Confederate flags. There were special Klan police at all entrances to the meeting hall, carrying walkie-talkies and wearing knives at their sides. The guards were dressed in black pants and white shirts, with the American and Confederate flags sewn onto the sleeves. They were also wearing black vests with a red and white Klan symbol over the left breast. Surrounded by the guards, the ironically named Black said he thought the conference was a success. Other members of the group said they were enjoying the meeting and were looking forward to the rally. Black said there would be a cross-burning at a wedding at the rally. I don't think it's unfair. It's not like saying, hey, we're imposing the values of 2020 on somebody 39 years ago. But there's not a word in here. And again, this is you open the Sunday paper, fold it open once, and this is at the top of the page with to one side Sadat continuing Egyptian cleanup, because this is before they blew away Anwar Sadat. This is Sunday morning. This is what you read Sunday morning before you head off to church. And with all the talk of white supremacy and doing God's work by getting rid of mixed racial shows on television and in the movies, there's not a word of criticism of these disgusting, filthy, sleazy, murderous, anti-American thugs. Not a word. Because back then, Reagan was in the ascendancy. And just as white supremacist adjacent illegitimate Florida governor Ron Monkey Up DeSantis only became governor of Florida with the actual aid of real live, no kidding, Nazi robocalls, so too Ronald Reagan and the Republican Party God damned well understood that he was president because of people like the disgusting vermin who attended that meeting in Tuscumbia, Alabama on Saturday, the 5th day of September, 1981. And it felt to me when I saw this scrap of newspaper. So yeah, I couldn't do that if it wasn't a real ancient piece of newspaper. I stopped what I was doing last Saturday when I saw that. I was stunned. Not so much by the content, but by the wave of just crushing irony that washed over me to be seeing that in this time. It was as though, and I know they didn't, but it was as though my parents had prepared a time capsule for me. And Agnes walked in eventually and saw me just standing there holding it and said, "What are you looking at?" And I just handed it to her. And she said, "Oh my God." Because this really does put in perspective where we are now. You can't have Charlottesville in 2017. And you cannot have the massive police violence against the black community without that. Without the upsurge in white supremacy that came with the arrival of Ronald Wilson Reagan, old 666 himself, in the White House. Ronald Wilson Reagan brought with him people like Ed Meese. And various members of his cabinet who spent their time dog whistling too. Talking about welfare queens. And prompting vast hordes of formerly Democratic voting white folks to declare, "Oh, I didn't leave the Democratic Party." It was still the Democratic Party then. Newt Gingrich had not yet perverted the language. "I didn't leave the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party left me." And what they meant by "the Democratic Party left me" is the Democratic Party had embraced elements of inclusion, equality, and civil rights in its into its DNA. This was the generation that 15 years before LBJ, upon signing the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Act, had said, "We have lost the South for a generation." Well, it turned out to be more than a generation, but this was when they got their chance. When they overturned a Baptist Sunday school teacher's presidency in favor of a greasy-headed old B-movie actor who had all the all the religiosity of an old hollered-out stump, but was able to make like he did, and appearances were all that mattered. It's all that ever mattered to the evangelicals. It's at this self same time that Jerry Falwell begins his rise to prominence with something he called the moral majority, which was neither moral nor a majority. That's the starting point. George Floyd was a child back then, with no idea that the things that were going on were going to set forces in motion that would eventually wind up with a white supremacist cop's knee on his neck as he pled, "I can't breathe," and called out for his dead mother. Actions have consequences, and these are they. Eric Garner, probably not born by then, but because of what happens with the Republican bowing and scraping before white supremacy, he would be on a road to death before he was even conceived. And the same for Tamir Rice and Trayvon Martin, Philando Castile, Sandra Bland, Breonna Taylor, on and on and on. Imagine imagine a city, county, and state, and federal government that would stand idly by while knife-bearing Klansmen set up their own paramilitary police force at a conference in a publicly funded structure. That's what happened back then. It stopped me in my tracks. Because seldom do you get that. Does the universe just hand you a roadmap saying, you know, you're here, but you used to be there. And there's a road that runs through time as a line does on a map between the two points. Klansmen group for conference. Not filthy Klansmen, not, and you know, frankly, I don't think the phrase domestic terrorists had entered the lexicon yet. That goddamned article refers to them as everything but very fine people. And for the most part, wherever you lived, for all you knew, the postman who delivered your mail, the bank clerk who cashed your check, the grocery store checkout person who sold you your groceries, your minister, your lawyer, the judge, any one of them could have been Klan. And had it been discovered, precisely nothing would have been done about it. This, then, is one of the roles of history, to remind us that we do not bob around like a cork at the end of a fishing line in the whirls and eddies of time, but that in fact we and those who came before us and those who come after are travelers on a road. I don't see how I can throw that scrap of newsprint away. And I'm a little bit disturbed at the prospect of unboxing that glassware for fear of what else 1981 may have to show me. Because how fascinating it is that something from the past can act more like a crystal ball. Has there been progress made? Maybe. Some. Obviously not nearly enough. One would like to think that if a Klan group tried to have a conference in the Tuscumbia Multipurpose Center now, that they would be told to fuck right off. But it's not even necessarily a sure thing. because the Nazis and Klansmen certainly marched in 2017 in Charlottesville, didn't they? And they had places where they gathered before they marched, shouting, "Jews will not replace us." For me, perspective matters. Because it's hard, from where I stand, it's hard to solve problems when one doesn't necessarily fully understand how the problem started. And this was just a continuation. This was a somewhat diminished, but still busy, Klan. Not nearly what it had been in 1950s and 60s, Mississippi and Alabama, Tennessee, etc. But somehow or another, they kept their message alive. And continue to. Because we fetishize the First Amendment and allow domestic terrorists to hide behind it. And we do so to our eternal shame, and in particular, and even more so, our eternal agony. So that now, for instance, we learned about a man named Stephen Carrillo, C-A-R-R-I-L-L-O, curiously, a white supremacist in California who murdered a pair of Santa Cruz County deputies, murdered one, maimed another, and then used their own blood to write the word boog, B-O-O-G, short for boogaloo, on the car. He also scrawled, "I became unreasonable." That's one of those catchphrases of the white supremacist movement. And it comes from Marvin Heemeyer. And he was a nut job in Colorado who bulldozed 13 buildings in Granby, Colorado over a zoning dispute. And then, June 4th, 2004, after bulldozing the buildings, he offed himself. And then, a little closer to not closer to home, but a little bit more indicative of exactly what we're dealing with here. A news item. Facebook has disallowed some Trump campaign ads because they use Nazi iconography to describe people who are decidedly not Nazis. But it doesn't end there. The Nazi dog whistling from the Trump campaign, because the people who pay attention to this sort of thing have their, like I said, their symbologies, their iconographies, And they ran, the Trump campaign did, 88 such ads. 88 being a really important number to the Nazi and white supremacist right. Because H is the eighth letter of the alphabet, and thus 88, as you'll see on like white supremacist tattoos and whatnot, 88 is HH, which in turn is Heil Hitler. And the Trump campaign deliberately ran 88 ads. The universe will not countenance coincidences like that. Not by a long shot. So we see where we are, and thanks to a piece of newsprint casually used to wrap a glass 39 years ago, we find out how we got here. How we got to places like Montana, where a pasty-faced, doughy white guy brandishing a shotgun was finally arrested a week or so ago when he when 60-year-old Jim Daniels made a death threat against a co-worker. Reporting coming from the Bozeman Daily Chronicle. The co-worker had immigrated from Brazil, and 60-year-old Jim Davis, brandishing his shotgun, said, "In Montana, we kill people like you." A story from the Bozeman Daily Chronicle says, "The victim, who is Brazilian, has worked at Rent for Less in Bozeman for 2 years, and said the racial threats by Daniels started as comments about the color of his skin. Those comments eventually escalated, and Daniels on several occasions brandished a shotgun and tried to provoke the victim into a fight." The victim would sometimes, 60-year-old Jim Daniels would sometimes show the victim the shotgun and say, "My shotgun's name's Betsy, and someday you're going to meet Betsy." Well, he's been booked for felony malicious intimidation. Then, a couple of weeks back, there was panic in Newport Beach, California, as a shirtless white man with a pistol walked up to a black man and shouted, "Black lives don't matter!" And then pointed the pistol at his victim and then ran away. Oh, and by the way, the guy that squeezed off a few rounds in Albuquerque the other day and shot and critically injured a protester. Well, the charges have been dropped against him. No kidding.
because he was just trying to defend himself with his freedom protector.
Then there's Bakersfield, California. Where Erica Bays and her little girl were going back home after a Black Lives Matter protest. When a white woman began screaming at them that they didn't belong there, and she was a-calling the police. She took video of the woman. Who, at one point on the video, says, "I will fucking kill you!" And then her husband intervenes. In San Antonio at a protest, a guy named David Rangel went on Twitter to say, "Attention, Antifa or any Antifa soldiers coming to San Antonio today. If you show up at the Peel complex, I will personally kill you." Police said he had a long history of mental illness and alcohol abuse. And so they arrested him. Then there's the city commissioner of Ashland, Kentucky, just across the river from West Virginia. She resigned as a city commissioner. A social media Facebook message came to light. That message described the Black Lives Matter protests over the police murder of George Floyd as Planet of the Apes. That message went on to say that the author hoped that all the rioters spread coronavirus to one another. The author of that post was Ashland City Commissioner Patricia Steen's son. And she refused to condemn it, writing instead, "Anyone who knows me knows my heart, and I've always tried to have the best interest of all of Ashland's citizens as my only motivation as a city commissioner. With that said, I believe my presence on the commission would only be a distraction from the work the commission has before it, and I have therefore decided to resign my seat on the commission, effective immediately." Planet of the Apes. Yeah. Then down Georgia way, young black man accidentally brushed up against an automobile owned by Thomas Langdale. Once again, the incident captured on video, because we all carry cameras now. The family was celebrating the young man's high school graduation and had gone to the grocery store. When Thomas Langdale yelled out, "I've been watching him in my rearview mirror. He doesn't need to brush up against my car. He's not worth enough to brush up against my car. Don't ever come up beside my car again." And then pointed his freedom protector at them and used a racial slur. The young man's father, Eric Dawson, said he pointed it directly at me and in my face. All I could see was the barrel of that gun. Then he said, I'll shoot you. I'll kill you. I said, put the gun down. Fight me. Fight me. At that point, a bystander got between them, and, well, the police came and arrested Langdale, and I don't know, maybe they took him to Burger King. I could do this for the next 3 hours. There's that many stories. Jesus. And meanwhile, the coronavirus is setting record after record after record. Single day record in South Carolina today. New COVID-19 cases with 987 and four more deaths reported. And because West Virginians just can't help themselves and have to go to Myrtle. Well, we got us a brand new COVID-19 cluster in Preston County, West Virginia. There are three positive tests and several more still pending. All the cases, every one of those positive cases in Preston County have one thing in common. They all have recently been to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, where McGovna is continuing to weaponize the coronavirus in an act of bioterrorism. The County Health Department in Preston County, West Virginia, which is just the county directly to the east of Monongalia County, wherein resides Dan Fisher and my alma mater, Harvard on the Mon. Preston County, immediately to the east, their health department is now asking all Preston County residents who have traveled back to the county from Myrtle Beach or any other crowded vacation destination to self-quarantine for two weeks. They're asking. They're not telling, though. Because freedom. Jesus. Well, we found a way to, and there's the filibobster. Thanks to Charlene in Rogues Island. Thank you very kindly for finishing off Ralph's challenge in honor of Dan's appearance this evening. Thank you very kindly. And Charlene also got us started on the rest of it. So that means that, ciphering, you know. We got $415 to come up with to come even with this thorn in the side Thursday. Thank you, Charlene. And hopefully Charlene and Jeremy and Ralphs will have some more company as the program continues onward. And so without further ado, I'm just tickled pink-er, to have Dan Fisher joining us this evening from his abode there somewhere in the suburbs of the greater New York area. Dan, how are you?
I'm fine, dude. How are you?
Dude.
Let me see some. I'm getting a little... Hold on. Let me take these off. I had earphones on, and I was getting a little feedback. I'm not feedbacking on you, right?
No, you're fine.
Okay, good. Yeah, sorry to start out so awkwardly.
That's okay, but whatever you just did is now sending me back at me.
Oh shit. Okay.
Now, if you stay with your headphones, I think it will resolve.
Okay.
It's something to do with Skype. It settles down after the call starts. It's, you know, Microsoft bought Skype, and then everything went to hell.
Folks, we don't do sound checks around here or anything. Maybe we should. But
sibilance.
Let me see if it's echoing now. It doesn't seem to be echoing now. So
you're going to.
I'm good. Am I good with you?
You're great.
Okay. So that's enough of that. We're testing the audience's patience right off the bat. But we sure have a lot to talk about, don't we, Bob?
Oh, there's a lot going on out there, Dan.
I kind of warned you, and I'm going to warn your listeners, too. This is not going to be as fun, probably, as some of the past ones. I'm in no mood to talk about Galaxy Quest or what fun movies I've seen recently, that kind of stuff. You know, since June 1st, especially, since George Floyd's murder, I've been a bit more somber than the past. And I'll try not to be what's the character on Saturday Night Live? The one that's always Debbie Downer. I'll try not to be Debbie Downer too much. But if you're expecting my usual twinkling, trivial charm, you might not get that as much tonight. I'm sure I won't be able to help myself, but I'll try to be more.
Strong. I think people understand, and if it should happen, don't beat yourself up, because among other things, we are all awash, or at least people of conscience are, Dan. Mm-hmm. In angst, in agonies, in horror, in empathetic sorrow. And that takes a toll.
Well, I'll tell you too, the thing about George Floyd and the results of the actions after that, I mean, I think like a lot of white people, I realized all along that I've considered myself an ally, whatever you want to call it. But I haven't done nearly enough, and I'm not doing enough now. And no, I don't mean to make it sound like I need to carry the weight of the world on my shoulders, but I know also that now is not the time for silly lists about movies about robots or anything like that. Now's the time to get serious, and I'll try to be serious in an entertaining way for the next 2 hours. But I'm not in the mood to go over lists. I suspended my Facebook column that I've been doing called Rank 'em, where I create lists of movies and TV shows, and I know it's fun. But, you know, during the COVID crisis, I felt like I could continue then because what else were we going to do, right? I'm not going to invent a serum. I'm not going to, you know, I was doing all I could do, which is stay the hell inside, wear a mask, wear gloves. I was doing everything right, and still all I could do is sit and wait. So it seemed like at that time to create lists or open discussions about, you know, my favorite movies of my childhood or a commercial that is funny, that seemed okay at the time. We all needed to pass the time however we could. But then after the murder of George Floyd, you know, it was unfortunately for me, you know, self-professed liberal, it was a wake-up call that, you know, you need to keep your eye on the prize and you need to do more. You think you're doing enough, but you're not. And by you, I mean myself. I'm talking to myself. So, you know, that's a lot of it. And I hope you don't mind if I share something, which was that, you know, after George Floyd's murder, you did contact me June 1st to say, would I like to come on and talk? And I thought about it and I decided not to, because what I've now come to realize, if you want to call it that, is that there are times for us white people to, you know, to talk, and we do love to talk, and I do right now and here, but there's times for us to sit down, shut up, and listen to other people who don't look and think like us, specifically in matters of racial suffering and conflict. We have to listen to black people, and we have to allow ourselves not to take center stage, but to be supporting characters. And throughout this show tonight, by the way, Bob, I invite any of your listeners, if I say anything that makes it sound like I'm speaking on behalf of black people, or if I say they or those people or anything like that, or black voters instead of the people, I don't even know how to put it. But if you feel I'm speaking on your behalf unnecessarily or saying things in an unintentionally racist way, I want you to email and I want you to say, you know, don't use that, or no, that's not your place. Because I really want to just listen like crazy as much as I can. I'm not going to sit here for 2 hours and just, you know, in silence. But I want the conversation being that I listen a little more than usual. And now it's your turn to talk.
Well, I think you've got a you're departure point is solid. And I, when, you know, when you wrote back like that, I understood completely what you were getting at. And I've been trying to the best of my abilities to let this be a forum for people to speak their minds, because from this, from the inception of this radio program, Dan, it has been a right-wing free zone.
Right.
I have said all along, all people of good faith and good goodwill are welcome in this conversation, but that precludes all Republicans, Trump
yes.
types, maggots, you know, Make America Great Again Trump supporters. That's what maggots stands for. Because there's no room for anybody who doesn't want to solve problems, who doesn't want to seek a better way. And
right.
And so I felt that discomfort too, but mm-hmm. I actually sat down and thought about, you know, how to deal with all of this, but there's no way for me just to, I don't think I would be doing anyone any good by just turning the program off until this is over.
No, I don't mean because to suggest
this is,
that.
But no, I know you don't, but this is not the, but because the larger point is until this is over is a false premise. This
right.
is never going to be over, at least until such time as we stop tickling around the edges and go deep for massive, substantive, for lack of a better term, meaty change.
Right. Unfortunately, there is no vaccine for racism. You know, we may overcome COVID-19 sometime or other by vaccine. But this will always be the virus, the bug that is niggling at us and infecting us and making us collectively sick.
And the thing is, you know, there's you, for one, having been through what you've been through, you know full well the difference between acute and chronic.
Yes.
And what I would say, to use medical terminology, is that what we are experiencing right now is an acute breakout of a chronic disease.
Mm-hmm. I have to apologize because I haven't listened. I've listened to what I did in the past couple of days prior to coming on this was I just sort of point and clicked my way through your past 2 weeks of shows just to sort of hear what you've been talking about and how you've been approaching it. And certainly I don't mean to suggest that you should give up your forum. I mean, you have a very powerful forum, a very powerful stage to present messages, and you know, you and I were discussing the last time around about the word truth, and I like to call it data. You know, these days truth is just so malleable that you know, let's just call it data. And you have a very, you know, very unique and powerful platform for that, and I know you approach this thoughtfully, and even in my own meager way, I do too. I do have, you know, over 1,000 friends on Facebook, and I do have people that seem to just keep coming to my posts over and over. And what I try to do in my posts is I try to not just post a link to something, you know, let's all agree on the same thing. I don't try to create an echo chamber. I want a conversation, and I don't really want conversations with the maggots. I agree with you. I think that there's a certain amount of uselessness to that, of even engaging and going down rabbit holes, because that's what they want. It's rope-a-dope. They're just going to keep, you know, whataboutting and piling on the lies as much as they want to. It's a game to them. Survival of people is not what it's about for them. It's just a big fucking game, and I'm not going to play that. But what I do know, and again too, what I don't want to ever do is feel like I'm trying to explain something or to lecture any black person, any person who is not white, which we would call people of color. I don't want to be in that position of being the white messiah. And I have to, when I do post something, when I do say something here on Facebook, in my life, at the dinner table with my daughter and my wife, I do kind of slow down the conversation in my head because I do want to say the right things. And I'm very aware that sometimes I'm not going to say what I should have said, or I will say something that I'll later think about and regret, because I've got 56 years of living in me. And I am part of a system that is racist. I am part of an educational system that didn't tell me a lot of things that I should have known, whether it's about history of Black Americans or Hispanics or colonialism or unions in my own state. I didn't get that education. It wasn't provided for me. And it's only been through bits and pieces of these 56 years. And honestly, through my wife and my daughter. My daughter Phoebe is 20 years old and goes to McGill University, and she is studying for the LSAT, and she will be, I think, a civil rights attorney or something related to that. And she just blows me away. She can just, you know, she is the prosecuting attorney, and I just have to plead guilty a lot of times to my own ignorance of things or my limited perspective on things. So. I here I am again. I'm on a soapbox just saying, talking this much. You know, it's kind of like holding a mirror up to a mirror. You're just going to go down this path of, I don't want to dominate the conversation, and yet I can't stop talking about it.
But Dan, there's a difference between dominating a conversation and a legitimate search for understanding.
Absolutely.
And you're self-critiquing on the fly, thinking you're doing one when it sounds to me much more that you are doing the latter.
I'm just trying to search and I'm trying to listen. You know, I'm trying to read more. You know, my daughter loaned me a book. I forget the name of it offhand about the system of incarcerating young Black men and how that's, I think it's called the New Jim Crow, and I forget who wrote it. But, you know, I have to confess to you and to your listeners, all through my life, I haven't really put much thought into that. That the penal system is something of a continuation of Jim Crow laws and a continuation of slavery. That it's to disenfranchise a great portion of people, you know, because they might have sold marijuana at one time or you know, relatively harmless things, or even if they've done harsher crimes. Once you're paroled, you still have no rights and you have no life for the rest of your life. Forget about a system of being of coming clean and of paying your debt to society. That no longer applies to young Black men. So there's a lot I'm still stretching my brain around, and I'm willing to admit that there's a lot I don't know, and I'm freaking
and
old.
You
man.
You touched on something a couple of minutes ago, talking about all the things you didn't learn that were not taught to you, and. What I think that brings up is that there has been, and I don't care what part of the country you're in, there has been, because I experienced it. Hell, I was in Alabama, but West Virginia, and I dare say other parts of the country, like I said as well. And it's not so much an education; it's not so much a public education as it has been a public miseducation.
Yes,
a deliberate and concerted attempt. To keep people, to keep children from learning things that they have an absolute right to know.
Yes.
And not just a right, but a necessity, Dan.
And it's been a very successful campaign, this deliberate reinterpretation of what history supposedly is. You're 100% right. It is deliberate. And it's because, you know, all lives have not mattered for a long, long time. All lives really still, of course, right now, really means white lives to way too many people.
Well, anybody who uses that phrase, at this point in time, I'm willing just to say, okay, you under the most generous of interpretations, you simply don't understand. And
you refuse to.
And you refuse to. Or there's always the possibility you know, just white supremacist.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing too, that I've really come to understand is it is so shaded. There are so many varying degrees of racism. And what I have learned really, especially through in these past 3 weeks, is what matters more to a lot of white people, including a lot of white, quote unquote, liberal people, the only thing they hate more than racism itself is being called on it.
Or having to talk about it.
having to talk about it because, yeah, there's another book that my wife's reading right now that I haven't yet cracked called White Fragility. And I want to get to that one.
Tracy has been talking about that one on this program. She gave a list the other a few nights ago, and that was on it.
I'm sorry I missed it. I really like Tracy a lot.
She sent me a book that I read. Didn't take 2 days, but it just did my head in. A woman by the name of Joy DeGry, and it's called Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome.
Hmm.
And it outlines it's a real thing. It tries to outline what that heritage, just the knowledge of that heritage, does to people. And while you said we were not going to, and we're not
people
going to,
people specifically black people,
yes,
white people,
yes,
or both.
No, well, there's a negative impact in both, but it's aimed at what it does to the black psyche,
which is true trauma, right?
Yeah,
right.
Because it's PTSS. It's the same thing that any trauma has after effects, and this is by way of identifying that heritage as a standalone trauma all its own.
Mm-hmm.
That had not heretofore been properly approached. Let's do go in and because I mentioned at the beginning of the program that we would probably be discussing Gone with the Wind. Let's go ahead and take that one on, please.
Yeah, because that's something I feel to a degree I can be a little more discursive about, right? Because I'm the movie guy, I'm the pop culture guy. And also, listen, I'm from West Virginia and also of a certain generation. Right. I mean, I remember I think it was in the early 70s, maybe 73, 74, maybe later, where Gone with the Wind was presented on network television for the first time ever. It was a two-part, I think, NBC event, and it was a huge deal. And I remember also at that time that the AFI, American Film Institute, listed Gone with the Wind, I think, as number 6 in the all-time 100 greatest American movies ever made. And Jimmy Carter, even, who was president at that point, had said something, had made a joke about, you know, how he liked it, that movie. I can't remember the exact joke. But yeah, Gone with the Wind. Where to begin about that? Well, I mean, to me, basically, Gone with the Wind is a racist fairy tale. That's really it. And if we all like fairy tales, right? We all like to hear things that make us feel good, that are reassuring, the same way a bedtime fairy tale did when we were small children. And Gone with the Wind tells a fairy tale story of a woman who, after 4 hours, comes to the conclusion in the very final scene that the only way she's going to get by in this world is to work the earth with her own hands, which is something her slaves have been doing all their lives. So you haven't really grown that much, Scarlett. But we won't even, we will get into the topic of depictions of happy slaves.
Well, that and I would also like to examine it within the context, the milieu, whatever, of, you know, the first great American film was,
well, a lot of people thought Birth of a Nation was that. Yeah. Woodrow Wilson, who was also known racist and white supremacist, said it was like watching history written by lightning.
Yeah. And of course, it was based on a novel whose actual title was The Klansman. And the Klansman of the title was the hero of the piece.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, listen, here's the myth, too. The myth is that those of us who object to Birth of a Nation and to Gone with the Wind are trying to, quote unquote, erase history, that we are trying to extinguish these things altogether and pretend they never existed. Now, I am a film historian. I mean, not professionally, not academically, but I care very deeply about film history. And through my silly little trivia lists and through the times I've spoken with you about movies, part of that is with that in mind, that I want new generations of people to hear about a movie, a film that they might not have heard of, and understand its impact, understand why Citizen Kane is important. Even if you think it's boring, it's important. But let's get back to that, to Birth of a Nation and to Gone with the Wind. In neither case do I want to see those removed from the ability to be seen by adults. Now, there's a difference here then between that and Song of the South, because Song of the South was made and marketed and distributed to children, including me. When I was a kid, I saw Song of the South at the Works Drive-In in New Martinsville, West Virginia. And I thought it was a fine, good, fun movie. I had a Song of the South, Br'er Rabbit and His Pals storybook at home that my mom would read to me at night, of the Tar Baby and the Will of the Wisp, I think it's called. And I even drew, I learned how to draw cartoons by mimicking those illustrations. Nowadays, or even, you know, 20 years ago, when I was a father of two very young children, of course I would never let my kids see Song of the South. I don't want my kids growing up thinking that slaves were happy to be slaves, any more than I want people to believe, both adults or children, that slaves were terrified. Gone with the Wind says that slaves were terrified of the Yankees and loyal to their masters and looking to their masters to protect them from those awful, evil Yankees. All of it is just, it's horrific imagery. It's, the thing is about Gone with the Wind, though, it's beautiful imagery. Max Steiner wrote the score. He's the guy that did the score for King Kong. He's one of the great film composers of all time. This was one of the first color movies, I think,
and they
ever
used,
presented to the public.
Yeah, they used, it was Technicolor, wasn't it?
Technicolor, yeah, widescreen. It's gorgeous.
It is, because they pulled out all the stops to make it as beautiful as it was, because just as was the case with the technical brilliance of Birth of a Nation, which was a silent film, they used the very best technology they had to advance a deliberately racist trope, and so therefore they wanted it to be as stunning as it was, so that it could have the impact that was desired.
Absolutely. And they presented the triumph of the Union over the Confederacy as a tragedy, as something we should feel really, really bad about, because Scarlett loses her home, and what will she ever do, and fiddle-dee-dee. Now, think about it, too. This came out in 1939. So I'm sure it was starting the development process in 36, 37. I can't remember what year the Margaret Mitchell book came out. But, this was the hottest property in the world. But that's what, 50 years since slavery was abolished, less than that. So it's like trying to rewrite the history of the Vietnam War by saying, the Viet Cong were actually really great folks, or Richard Nixon was right. You know, it would be like somebody making a movie about Watergate and having Richard Nixon as the victim of it all. That's what Gone with the Wind did, and Birth of a Nation as well. But Birth of a Nation advanced the art of film. That is undeniable. What D.W. Griffith was able to do in his storytelling, his use of the camera and imagery, it made it possible for Citizen Kane. It made it possible for John Ford and for everything that came about Star Wars and all, everything after that. That was a very major seed. But do I want to watch? Do I want to give money to the people who own the rights to Birth of a Nation? I don't. You know, would I watch Gone with the Wind if it didn't have that the new disclaimer or panel discussion, whatever they're adding? No, I haven't watched it in at least a decade. I hated it as a kid. I knew that it was racist even as a kid, but that didn't bother me so much as the fact that it was just fucking boring. It's a 4-hour movie, and the first 2 hours is pretty fun. You know, I think it ends on that shot of pulling back and pulling back. You see the one dead soldier, you see 100 dead soldiers, and finally the Confederate flag in the foreground. I think that takes you to intermission.
I think
that's
you're
2 hours in.
Yeah.
You've got 2 hours after that about, you know, girls falling off of horses, and is Rhett going to leave or not leave? And as an 8-year-old and as a person who still, you know, has watched it in his adulthood a few times, I think it's just bloody boring and unnecessary. I think that, you know, you look at the movies that came out in 1930.
Self-indulgent, perhaps?
What's that?
Self-indulgent, perhaps?
Oh, sure. Sure. You know, and that, a lot of it's on Margaret Mitchell, although, I mean, they could have adapted it to, you know, cut the book in half or something. But it's like a lot of it. You know, if you get a massive book like that or The Hobbit, there's always that question, how much are you going to cut? Are you going to do the whole damn thing? I just want to say one other thing, too, is that, you know, Gone with the Wind was the first color picture to win the Best Picture Oscar in 1939. In that same year, they could have given it to The Wizard of Oz. Now, to me, that's a movie that has lasted and will last forever in terms of its importance and its influence on filmmakers and to children. It has inspired children who grew up to be Martin Scorsese and Steven Spielberg and anybody. Spike Lee was inspired by Wizard of Oz. I'm sure he wasn't inspired in a good way the first time he saw Gone with the Wind. I would hope not. But also in that same year, what could the Academy pick for Best Picture besides Gone with the Wind or Wizard of Oz? It could have picked Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, which is a celebration of the power of democracy and the people's control over their own representatives. Yeah. But they went with the racist fairy tale. What can I tell you? You know, it was the Titanic, the Twilight, the Star Wars of its time. It certainly was. Its impact, its popularity, none of that can be either forgotten or denied. But what we can do is we can talk about it differently, and we can think about it differently when we watch it. And by we, I don't just mean you and me, who are already predisposed to do that. We can have the guy sitting next to us on our couch or the person who we go to work with the next day. We can talk about it with them, and they might tell you about how romantic it is or how they visited that plantation one time on their summer vacation down in Georgia, and it was so lovely and pretty and wonderful, and they might even have their daughter's wedding there. But that's all nonsense. It's all horseshit, fairy tale racism. And we have to tell our friends who don't think they're racist but kind of are, we have to slowly and incrementally teach them of what reality and truth is. And that if you think that, you know, that taking Gone with the Wind temporarily off of HBO Max, and I emphasize the word temporarily, if you think that is quote unquote erasing history, that means you think that a movie is giving you history. And Gone with the Wind is not history. It's not an accurate depiction of history any more than a statue is, any more than a bottle of pancake syrup is. I mean, if I'm going to the movies for my history, I'm going to believe that Queen put out the album News of the World in 1974 instead of 77, like Bohemian Rhapsody tried to tell me. I know my Queen, and that was full of shit. Now, that doesn't upset me nearly as much as this idea that slaves were never raped, that slaves were happy with their situation, that they were provided for very well and just wanted jobs until the Yankees came and took it all away from them. That gets me a bit offended, as the maggots like to point out. They love using that word, offended, often in large, all-cap letters. Didn't mean to offend you, you know, as if that's the worst thing in the world, to be offended. Okay, try the word pissed off. You pissed me off because you're an asshole. How about that?
That works.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's basically my feelings about Gone with the Wind. I've never liked it. I acknowledge it. I don't want to get rid of it. I think a panel, I hope what they don't do, because I don't think it's back yet, but I know that HBO has talked about putting additional material on. I hope it isn't just a blurb on the screen saying some viewers may find this offensive. I would like to see like a 5-10 minute, whatever they can get away with, conversation, like a DVD extra. You can put it at the end if you want, or maybe it's in the intermission to get people to stick around for it, to just have a couple of people, you know, have – well, I can't say the name right. Please help me. Coates, the author.
Ta-Nehisi Coates.
Ta-Nehisi Coates. Thank you. I apologize for not knowing how to pronounce that. Have somebody like that. Have somebody that really knows how to get down into the nitty-gritty to discuss it and give the context and change your mind a little bit.
I would like to ask a question, and this is based on your status as historian. This thing was shot during the era of studios, contract players,
right?
And so, you know, you might Vivian Leigh was English, was she not?
She was British, yes.
And she, let's see, I'm trying to think of anybody. Well, the point I'm trying to get at is, you know, you look at the script, you look at the overtness of it, and the covertness of it, because there is not a non-racist moment in the entire film.
Right.
And as I noted, it was late February or whatever, they screened it on TCM. I was talking about this at the beginning of the program. And Agnes and I sat there and watched it because I hadn't in forever. Uh-huh. And what struck me is there is not a decent character in the entire film save for the black characters.
Hmm.
Because they are all the rest of them are tainted by any number or combination of the seven deadly sins.
Isn't Olivia Havilland's character Melanie? Isn't she rather virtuous?
Yeah, but she even you know, but she's flawed too. She's got her own agenda that she will that she will let other people suffer for.
This is true. She's one of those I'm not a racist racists, right?
Yes.
She's standing by and letting it all happen.
Well, I think of Melanie, I think of the white liberals that Dr. King was talking about in Letter from Birmingham Jail, saying they're more harmful to the struggle than the open and above board Klansman is.
Mm-hmm.
Because they operate in terms of, well, you know, I certainly do agree with you, but you know, not right now. The time's
exactly
not right.
Right.
But my question is, under the studio contract system, if any of those actors had looked at the script and said, this is repulsive,
mm-hmm.
they really couldn't have done anything because of the nature of their contract status.
That's correct.
I mean, even,
unfortunately,
even somebody who was as big of a box office draw as Clark Gable was still beholden to the studio by virtue of the contract he was under.
Yeah. And what they could do is just not give him work if he, you know, they could blacklist him and it would be entirely legal if he had chosen not. But of course, you know, again, this was the hottest property at the time. And we do also have to always remember, and I try to remind my daughter this. This is one thing I do try to teach her is when you get into comparing the standards of now to then, we have to be careful because, yes, racism is racism, whether it's the 1930s or now. But the degree by which it was accepted, we can't retroactively go back and armchair quarterback that or change it, unfortunately. It existed, and it was also very tough. I'm defending racists, I guess, here. And again, call me out. I invite any listener to call me out if I say anything dunderheaded tonight. But you know, if you were going to make a stand, if you were any actor, Gable or anybody, if you were going to make a stand against the very production of Gone with the Wind at that time, that would be career suicide. You must then be prepared for the idea that you might not work in this town again, and the mansion and the lovely wife and all the things you've become accustomed to can go away. And I'm not saying it's then an obvious choice to make, but at the same time, it would certainly be a difficult choice. And if I can sidetrack for just 1 minute, and we'll get back to Gone with the Wind. You know, I was talking with my family recently about, you know, the story of the office of the actor on Mr. Rogers who played the neighborhood police officer. He's a black actor that appeared on the show sometimes. Not Speedy Delivery, but the other guy. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes,
do you know
I do.
This?
Yeah, I can't recall the character, but yes.
I can't recall the character, and I can't recall the actor's name. But you've probably seen the clip by now of Fred Rogers in sharing a swimming pool with that actor in the 1960s broadcast of the show at the time when integration of pools was a very hot topic, etc. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes,
do you know
I do.
This clip?
And just the very contemplation of that issue. My God.
Yes. Yes. But it also happened that actor, besides being black, was gay. And in the documentary, Won't You Be My Neighbor, he talks about how Fred Rogers, who was a minister, et cetera, had known that he was gay and said, and was accepting, quote unquote, of him, but said, you know, it would be better, I think, if you don't publicize this, if you just keep closeted, keep it on the down low. And that's what the actor chose to do. And my daughter, especially, and I don't mean to keep my daughtering this evening, but she didn't quite understand. She was like, well, that was just wrong, and Fred shouldn't have done that, and he's not as much of a saint as you present him to be. But it is true that if that actor had come out as gay in 1968, it would not only have wrecked his career, it probably would have wrecked the entire show, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, and possibly even PBS itself, because we also know that famous clip of Rogers in front of the Senate subcommittee getting funding for PBS just by his testimony. At least I think we do.
Yes.
So anyway, there is a domino effect to taking a stand, and I don't excuse cowardice, and maybe I am, but I do feel that I understand when people choose to step back, and I do understand when people choose to preserve their careers, their names, their reputations. Now, in the case of Gone with the Wind, again, let's get back to that. That's career suicide to turn down that. Now, it should be noted, though, Katharine Hepburn did audition for that part. She seemingly had no problem auditioning for it because it was the hottest part in town. And the truth is, it's a fabulous part for an actress at that time. I mean, I think Vivian Leigh deserved 100% to win Best Actress that year. She did. Gable did not win Best Actor, by the way, and neither did Jimmy Stewart. It went to Paul Donat for Goodbye, Mr. Chips. But Vivian Leigh, just that part itself, it was very different than the sort of victim prototype of a lot of women characters. I mean, in a lot of ways, Scarlett is a feminist. She does stand up for what she believes, and she's not afraid to be outspoken. She's not afraid to suffer for things she believes in. Unfortunately, the things she believes in is
slavery. Are the wrong things.
The wrong things. But there is – I guess I where I'm saw, going is it, context is everything.
I always thought it would have been an interesting piece of, like, you know, films or theatrical journalism. A comparison between Scarlett and Lady Macbeth. Because without a doubt, Lady Macbeth is the most interesting character that Shakespeare writes. She just also happens to be awful.
Yeah.
And you can say the same with Scarlett. She's probably one of the most interesting female characters in the first 50 years of film. She just also happens to be awful.
She would fit into the Ayn Rand form of self-interest, wouldn't she? She'd be a perfect Ayn Randian figure.
Yeah.
Both of them. But I'm sorry, go ahead.
No. I was simply going to say that in turn is a commentary on how men write female characters. Although the novel was, of course, Margaret Mitchell.
That would have been interesting.
Yeah, that would have been. But the film screenplay gets written by a guy.
Of course.
And so the only way you can make a female character interesting is to make her really a really truly genuinely awful human being. That says something all by itself. I did want to sort of loop back for a second. In terms of the timeline, there's a reason that the novel gets written when it does and the movie gets made when it does. 1939 is, for all intents and purposes, 75 years, ciphering on the fly. Mm-hmm. 40 plus 35 is 75. It's basically 75 years from the end of the Civil War.
Oh, I thought, forgive my math. What year did the Civil War officially end?
1865.
Oh, okay.
But
yeah, you're right. I did the math wrong.
But that 75-year mark is important because there were commemorations in the 75th anniversary year, and there had been before then. Ken Burns featured prominently in his somewhat sketchy Civil War documentary. old silent footage, I think, of the 50th anniversary of Gettysburg, of old bearded veterans, Southern veterans walking up the hill to the Stonewall at Gettysburg and embracing Union veterans.
Mm-hmm.
And they're old, old men by then. They were almost entirely gone by 1939. But what was not gone was the lost cause narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing reinforced the lost cause narrative better than did Gone with the Wind. So to the as you point out, it ain't history.
Not at all.
There is no historical character named Scarlett O'Hara. There's no historical plantation called Tara. It's mm-hmm. it's entirely fictional. It is a product of the imagination of Margaret Mitchell.
And a very romanticized imagination.
Yes.
You know that.
But within that imagination, she entirely incorporates the lost cause. And you have mm-hmm. to understand the lost cause to understand what makes Gone with the Wind so goddamn pernicious. Because the lost cause was not created by the people who fought the damn war, neither Southern nor Northern. The lost cause was created by the next generation who were unable to cope with all the wrongness that that the South had been involved in. So they invent out of whole cloth this notion that the war was not about slavery, which we are now arguing about unto this damn day.
Unfortunately, yes.
But the lost cause is a response to Reconstruction. It's a response to, among other things, the Grant administration's attempts to secure true civil rights for the freed persons of the former slave regime, and it pissed them off to no end. All the Confederate flag iconography that finds its way into the flags of Georgia and Mississippi and so forth, that all comes about as a result of the lost cause. After Plessy versus Ferguson, the slaughterhouse cases and so forth, then you start seeing the fucking statues go up.
Yeah.
And they're put
I think the 1920s to the 1930s were the first peak, and then the 50s to the 60s were the second peak.
It was actually earlier than that.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you.
Because, Plessy ushers in, Plessy gives the Supreme Court's blessing to the bullshit idea of separate but equal.
Uh-huh.
And as a way of coming up, I think there's a legitimate comparison between, say, Gone with the Wind and Confederate statues in that they are both tangible, visible reinforcements of a social order that was created as a reaction to slavery being ended. It was a way of saying it may be off the books as law, but by God, it's in our hearts as reality.
Well, and this is the thing, too, about movies, especially movies, I think, and especially, for the first 50 years, obviously, movies were the dominant cultural force in the world. They overtook books, they overtook plays, and everything else. Movies became the most forceful means of communication until television raised its head in the 50s. But still to this day, between television, movies, internet, etc., visual narrative is the most powerful way to get a narrative across and to get an idea in people's heads that may not be true but feels true. You know, what do they call it? Truthiness? I think John Stewart might have
said Colbert.
Colbert did that one, truthiness?
Yeah.
Just as long as it feels true, it becomes true. As they said in The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, print the legend. I forget. Oh, God. I'm messing up my quotes. But when the legend becomes more interesting than the fact, print the legend. So, slavery is, quote-unquote, abolished. But Jim Crow comes along after that. And really, Jim Crow to this slavery era is sort of like Cherry Coke to original classic Coke. It's a little bit of a different formula, but it's still pretty much Coke. You know, it's still going to give you those Coke-like flavors. And that's what Jim Crow, and that's even what to this day, things like our penal system and voter suppression, all of that is still basically telling black Americans, you're not really quite us. You're Americans, but not like us. We're you're not blonde hair, blue eyed. You're not tossing a baseball in the fields of Kansas. You're just a little not us. And that's what those images, and that's what Jim Crow is about. And you know, those images sell that. I mean, D.W. Griffith was an unapologetic. Well, it's interesting. He was an unapologetic white supremacist. But then after the controversy of Birth of a Nation, he did try to make his epic of epics called Intolerance, which is longer and more elaborate, and I don't think was ever quite finished. I mean, they recreated – because the whole thing was to illustrate intolerance of other cultures and of other people throughout world history. And he recreated in I think, the California – desert, he recreated like the pyramids of Egypt and yes. The Sphinx. They built these sets that they eventually actually buried under the sand because it was cheaper to do that than to burn them or excavate or to eliminate them, to get rid of them. So they know damn well what they're doing. When somebody posts a meme that's fake, and I'd like to talk about an interesting fake meme in a few minutes.
Sure.
You know, they know what they're doing. They, you know, when somebody photoshops Obama, you know, standing with a bunch of, you know, terrorists or something like that, they know very well what they're doing. The power of the image is supreme, especially in the days of a limited attention span that is our America, 20th century to 21st century America. Our attention spans just get shorter and shorter and shorter. So all you need – you don't even need a four-hour movie now to tell you something. Just look at a meme and that's enough to convince you. Just a single image convinces you. Let me talk about – do you mind if I talk about the fake meme that I came up on today?
You talk about anything you want to. It's a regular joint.
Okay. So maybe you've already been talking about the Aunt Jemima Wars.
Haven't gotten there yet, but this would be a lovely time.
Right. I'm sure all of your listeners by now, being socially aware and et cetera as they are, have probably heard that there's controversy because Quaker Mills, which owns the rights to the brand of Aunt Jemima pancakes and syrup, wants to get rid of the brand itself. I know that throughout the recent decades especially, they've changed the image from that classic mammy with the kerchief on her head to being something more of a professional, modern-looking woman. But she's still called Aunt Jemima. And she's still serving up the pancakes to white folks without having the pleasure of being able to eat them herself. So that being the case, of course, this is now the new source of outrage for some people. People who do maggots, let's just call them. I call them MAGAs, but I appreciate the maggots. You know, a lot of these people are offended with capital letters and butthurt, as they also like to call those of us who strive for progress. They are butthurt because, you know, Quaker Oats is taking away a part of, quote unquote, their history. And this meme I saw today twice, both by old friends from West Virginia who I went to high school with. And one is actually kind of on my – I think she's been on my side on various liberal things I've posted. But she posted this meme that shows a picture of a woman named Nancy Green. And I'm going to just paraphrase, and I might get some of the details wrong, but it says, this is Nancy Green. She was the model and spokesperson for the Aunt Jemima products, and she was America's first black billionaire. She was an excellent cook, and she was very happy to go all around the world and endorse Aunt Jemima products, and she should be celebrated and not forgotten because this is part of black American history. So, first of all, I had to do my boilerplate response to both of these friends saying, you know that Aunt Jemima – the character Aunt Jemima – you know, Nancy Green is not Aunt Jemima. She did not invent Aunt Jemima. Aunt Jemima was invented back in the days of minstrel, and you know, the stereotype of the mammy and the rastus and the dumb, you know, the dumb jug-eared, bug-eyed, I don't know nothing about nothing stereotype. That was certainly not, this is, Aunt Jemima was never meant to honor Nancy Green. It was meant to honor, not to degrade a portrait of Black Americans, specifically the women. I mean, part of the reason I read that Black mammies were always depicted as fat was it so it could desexualize them. So because the house slaves were very often deliberately starved to remain skinny. And the light-skinned ones were always favored over the dark-skinned house slaves because those are the ones the master got to rape at will. And so the idea of having Aunt Jemima as a fat Black woman, very maternal, older, 40s, 50s, whatever, was to make her not sexually desirable, to make her safe for white eyes. But also it turns out, of course, that Nancy Green was not America's first Black female millionaire. Here's a trivia question. Do you know who that was?
I do not.
Madam C.J. Walker. Probably the only reason I know this is not from my my Black American literature class that I took at WVU, but because there's a Netflix movie on right now, just came out about a couple of months ago, about C.J. Walker, and it's called Self-Made, and it stars Olivia what's her name? Olivia, blanking on her name, the one that won the Oscar for The Help. Anyway, it's a movie it's a brand new movie that's on Netflix, all about the first Black American female millionaire. And there is no actual documentation that Nancy Green ever made $1 million in her life. It is true. She played that part all of her life. But another thing I posted when I did post in reply to my two friends who are good-natured people in a lot of ways, but I also gave them just a really quick little brief rundown of the history of negative Black portrayals of characters throughout pop culture, because this is stuff I know about, right? I know about Amos and Andy, and I know about Step and Fetch It, and I know about the I don't know nothing about birth, no babies, mammy stereotype, you know, that Black people weren't even allowed to be protagonists in movies until the 1960s. I think the only case might be like Imitation of Life in the 1950s, where she was a victim. And to this day, you know, Black characters are very often than not depicted as victims rather than the protagonists of what should be their own stories. Anyway, I responded with that, among other things. So, you know, people are still to this day, they just keep trying to change the narrative. They're trying to whitewash the story, to change what is considered fact until it becomes conventional wisdom, if not actual fact or data. And we have to just keep stopping this. We just have to keep telling truth to power. And we all have Google too. And we can't let ourselves be convinced by a meme or even a video. We have to do the work. When they say they want to preserve history, let's make them acknowledge what history really is and see if they're willing to preserve that. But somehow that kind of history doesn't count. All history doesn't seem to matter to some of these people. These people. By these people, I'm saying white people, by the way, if you didn't get that one.
Yes, I did.
I feel much better about criticizing fellow white people than I would anybody who's not my skin color.
Well, I've spent, you know, there's a whole lot of every program's research day that involves me putting my little head in my little hands and going, white people.
And listen, I'm not 100% woke. I'm not claiming I'm better than anybody else, which is, of course, a big sin. By West Virginia standards, the worst thing you could be is to think you're better than anybody else.
Yeah, don't get above your raisin.
Above your raisin, as I think you and I discussed before. I know that I've said and done and will continue to do racist, sexist, homophobic things in my life, hopefully unintentionally. But again, I have 56 years of a life having been taught things through school, through my community, through movies and television that turn out weren't the best way of thinking of things. You know, I don't even want to say correct, because then you get into that politically correct bullshit nonsense. You know, it will always be a learning process for me. And I hope it will always be a learning process for everybody who is willing to do the work, to acknowledge our sins, right? And isn't that part of Christianity? I know it is. I was raised a Christian.
Yeah, repentance.
The first step is to acknowledge your sins, confess your sins, and then work on redeeming those sins. I personally, you know, I there's a lot I don't believe about the Christian faith. I do find great value in asking forgiveness and confession. Unlike a lot of evangelicals, I don't think that's enough. I think that service, following up that confession, is essential to right the wrongs in a manifest physical way. And just saying I'm sorry isn't enough. And starting your sentences with "I'm not a racist, but" is the worst way in the world to start a sentence.
Well, that's just kind of a giveaway, isn't it?
That, and I had a black friend/boyfriend/roommate. There is no such thing, white people, as a get-out-of-racism-free card for life. It don't work that way. You're all capable. I'm capable. Bob is capable of saying stupid, ugly-ass shit that we are going to have to atone for. It's gonna
not to get all Meghan McCain and me it, but some of us are probably more prone to having that happen than others, because if you do something for, say, 3 hours a night, 5 nights a week for 16 years, and most of it is ad lib and improv, You're going to be working out pretty close to the edge without a net.
Hell, just coming on here tonight, for the first time in a long time, I came onto the show nervous. I'm very, very conscious of wanting to say things not stupidly. And one thing I should do is not interrupt you so much. So please continue.
No. That's what this is. That's where the magic happens. The interruptions are where the magic happens. Make no mistake about it.
That's true. You've had some really great interruptions too. So I should lay off myself a little on that one.
Just be good to you.
Here's the thing too. Go ahead.
I was just going to say the difference, I think. And I spend a lot, you know, in the earliest years of this broadcast, I would get done with the program and I would do what radio people do. And that is, I would air check myself. I would sit and listen. I would do the 3 hours and then I would listen to the 3 hours again.
Oh, good Lord.
And there were evenings where I would joke that, you know, I would end the evening curled up in a fetal ball, sucking my thumb in the corner because I hated things that I had said. Not trying to deliberately be mean or bad, but just things that made me, that wasn't a good one. But the one thing that I've learned over this period of time, and sometimes I do think about it in this way. Can you imagine somebody, well, there have been people who did. Can you imagine doing, let's say Vegas, because Vegas is famous for this kind of thing. Artist in residence, 3 hours a night, 5 nights a week for 16 years.
I've said it before. I'll say it again. I don't know how you do it.
Sometimes I look at it and this isn't me pogo sticking up onto the cross because I love this.
No.
But it becomes exhausting and there is potential in there for fucking up monumentally. And so the one thing that I've learned over this period of time is when you do, and someone writes to you and says, "You have hurt me."
Mm-hmm.
You have to take it seriously.
Absolutely.
And you have to be willing to say, and not necessarily to try to, you know, sometimes you try to explain what you were getting at, but sometimes you just say, "I'm sorry and I won't do it again." And I can think of a couple of examples. Out of my sarcasm and my smartassery, I used to say, "Well, that just makes me want to run a warm tub of water and sharpen the razor."
Mm-hmm.
Until I got an email saying, "Oh, please, Bob, don't ever say that again. Somebody I love did that,
right?
And it makes me live it all over again." Haven't done it since. Or the time when I jokingly referred to Agnes chasing me with an iron skillet. And a young listener to the program wrote and said, that happened in my world, and it scares me, and it makes me sad when you say it. So the image of the humorous image of Agnes chasing me with an iron skillet went out the door. Because it's more important to me not to hurt people than it is to get some sort of cheap fucking laugh.
And you know, the difference between you and me and the maggots is that they see that humility. They see that at being able to admit fault, to say the words, I'm sorry, forgive me. They see that as a sign of weakness.
Yes.
But it's 100% the opposite. Do you know how hard it is to just say and mean I'm sorry and really mean it? Don't just go, I'm sorry, but, or I'm sorry you feel that way, but to say, I'm sorry, I fucked up. That was insensitive. I wasn't thinking about you. I was only thinking about my own selfish goddamn self. I've been married for over 27 years, and I forget how long you've been married.
27.
The only way I've gotten this far is by learning to do that and mean it when I do it and try to learn from it after I've done it. That's the only way I still have a wife. Otherwise, I've been an asshole plenty of times in my marriage, and I will be again. But my wife is very good about calling me on shit. And when she does, I think about it, I listen, and I say, I'm sorry, you know, I was only thinking of myself, and I wasn't looking at it from your point of view, and I'll try to be better. I really regret it. I wish I'd never said it. I wish I'd never done it. And that is strength. That's not me bowing down to my wife. That's me having to give up my pride. And that's something that's hard as fucking hell to do. It's much harder than going into a bar and punching out somebody. You know, that's yeah. Anybody could do that. But to do that and to mean it, there are not a whole lot of things braver than that you can do on a daily basis. So, what was I going to say after that little bit of a sermon there? I did want to talk with you also about, I was thinking of a good analogy about, you know, what our responsibilities as white men are, you know, what can we do given our position, our privilege to help the cause of making sure that others get exactly, see, this is all I want. I want everybody out there, whether they're, whatever their sex, race, sexual preference or gender identity, I want them to have the exact same shit from birth that I'm promised, that I get automatically just because I'm the default. I'm the white man. And that's all. And you know, it might even be seen as a betrayal of my own race and my own sex that I legitimately want these things. But you see, I've never enjoyed playing a game where I cheat. It's not real. I'm going to be very sexist here and far more intimate than I should be. I'm going to tell you, I don't really care sexually. I don't care for silicone-enhanced breasts. When I am doing my male gaze upon a woman's breasts, which I've done because I'm a human animal, I like them real because that's authentic to me. And so I don't like cheating. I don't like getting to win because your daddy had more money than somebody else's daddy, or you have a different skin color than somebody else, or you're the Yankees and you have a lot more money, so you can draft all the best players you want. I like an even draft from birth. That's my goal. You know, if I can help in any way before I'm out of here, you know, I'm not going to do it all at once, and I'm not going to be the only one doing it by any long shot. But if I can contribute in some way or another, I'm going to keep working toward that goal. Everybody gets what I got, you know, and I didn't, you know, I wasn't born to a wealthy father. You know, my dad was working class, and, you know, I went to a West Virginia public school, and I've done okay. I could do better, but it's not about me. It's about everybody else. They should get to have those same basic things that are promised to them in the Constitution and that have been amended since, so that you're no longer three-fifths of a person. You're a person. You're an American. And what an American is, the definition of an American, has to expand to fit that. And it's 2020, by God. Just fucking get used to it. This is what America is. You don't like it? Get out. As we've been told many times, love it or leave it. This is America. It's not white people. It's not people with blonde hair and blue eyes throwing baseballs in a Kansas field. It's people in Detroit. It's people in Atlanta. It's Muslims. It's women. It's people who were born John and now identify as Janice. Those are all Americans, just the same as Bob and Dan, who are the, again, we're the default. We're older white men. That's the way it is. And, you know, it's something you and I talked about or started to get into. I do have an analogy for how I think that we as white men can contribute. Well, first of all, analogies aside, we can march if we can. I can't march. That's the other thing, too, that got me really frustrated and sort of down on myself in the past couple of weeks. I see the marches going on out all over the place and continuing to go on.
And
I want to be part of them.
Right.
I can't be part of them just yet. Medically, I'm just not allowed.
Yeah, and
that's frustrating.
Pre-transplant Dan would have.
Pre-transplant Dan would have probably to an extent, but pre-transplant Dan was very tied into his work. And I'm hoping, I can only speculate, that, you know, time would have changed me to be a little more aware that there are other things more important than making a movie. But pre-transplant Dan, well, post-transplant Dan is certainly more aware of it. And COVID Dan has a lot of time to read and look at things and wonder about how he can contribute as a white, cisgender, heterosexual, 56-year-old man. Here's things I can do. I recommend them for any of your listeners, whatever their age or their color. I can contribute money to Black Lives Matter, to the ACLU. Here's one of my favorite pet causes, and I think it's super, super important. Fair Fight. Have you talked about Fair Fight on your show?
We have, I think, during one of your appearances, maybe when Helene was with us.
Right. We got to just keep plugging and plugging Fair Fight. There's some other ones, too. I think it's Liberty Voters Initiative. There's some other ones. But any group that is combating voter suppression right now, as much as I want you to give money to Bob to keep the show going, we also need to just keep digging away against voter suppression. We need to donate to Fair Fight, which was sponsored by Stacey Abrams when she was cheated out of the Georgia governor spot by Kemp. What's his name? Brian Kemp? You know, the man who gets to count and certify as the votes is now governor. That is as brazen as cheating as I can imagine in the United States of America. And we saw what happened in the Georgia primary recently. This is all deliberate. This is a way to disenfranchise voices they don't want to hear.
This is not a voting accident.
It's not an accident. It's not, oops, we didn't know how to turn on the machines. This is they didn't want the machines in the first place, and they're deliberately making sure the machines don't work. And they're deliberately also posting wrong addresses on websites for where people can vote. And they have also – another trick they did was a number of people, including Stacey Abrams and a friend of mine, received ballots in the mail that were pre-sealed. So they had to like do the thing of running their envelopes over steam to be able to open the envelope to properly cast their ballots, or it wouldn't count. This I'm sure was done deliberately. It's rat fucker tactics. It's stuff that Nixon and his boys did way back in the early 70s. So we need to do that. If you can, if you feel comfortable getting out there, and even if you socially distance or you stand from afar and applaud those passing you by, we need to be part of marches. We need to get white faces with our black faces, with whatever color your face is. We need to be together on this, because part of the thing, too, in the post-rioting situations where, you know, a certain type of media has tried to hijack the narrative into they're all a bunch of looters intent on destroying America. And, you know, I don't want to get into to rioting, because I am a white man and I understand the anger behind rioting and I have my opinions about violence and so forth, but it's not my place to criticize nor even comment upon the validity of rioting.
Time out. I'm pushing back.
Okay.
because it is damned well anyone's place to point out the difference that the protest, that the as I've described it here before, that the Venn diagram of people who are protesting is almost a standalone circle away from the circle that is people who are looting.
That is correct.
Okay.
And that is the narrative we need
When video exists of a white guy dressed all in black with an umbrella and a hammer breaking out the windows in that auto zone in Minneapolis, that needed to be shown, and to a certain extent
Absolutely. It was, because
that was not Black Lives Matter. That wasn't
right.
even a black life.
Right.
Or the white woman setting the fire in the Wendy's in Atlanta.
Yeah, and again, there are forces at play both in the news sources, the quote-unquote news sources we know of, like Fox or OAN, to the president himself, and God knows, you know, what tangled web of it all, that, you know, their big job is to control the narrative, and we can't let them do that. We can't let them define what truth is. We have to keep pushing back. I mean, I think one of the greatest weapons against racism is the phone. And I think you talked about it just before I came on. We all now have little cameras in our pockets, and we all just have to keep recording and recording and posting and keep bringing those people, find out their names. I have no problem with if somebody's going to be a racist asshole, I've got no problem putting that person's name, where they work, all of that right there on Facebook and social media. Let them have to reckon with it. And of course, what they're going to do is a couple of days later, they're going to appear on some Fox or whatever, doing a tearful semi-apology, how they're not really racist and it's not who they are and it was all misconstrued and it's all the media's fault and they're really the victim. You know, that's going to happen, but we just have to keep pushing back of what the narrative is, of what truth is. And I'm not even talking manipulating the narrative. I'm just saying getting reality out there and not letting non-reality become reality. That's super important. But here's the thing, too, that I really want, my analogy part is this. I know that there, you know, we all know that there are 38% of the country right now are committed maggots. And no matter what, we're not going to change those minds. I propose don't even bother. I propose going about our personal lives the same way that the presidential campaigns are right now doing, which is they're not sending Biden people into the middle of West Virginia. Not really. Maybe two trips you'll see a Biden appearance. But they're targeting on the swing states, right? They're going after those 6, 7, maybe 8 states, which could go either way. And right now, thankfully, are heading in the direction of the Democratic Party. Think of some of your friends as swing states. There are white friends we all have, white people I'm talking to right now. I'm addressing white people specifically. We all have white friends who are liberal, but yet they say and do things sometimes which are a little bit sketchy. You know, again, one of the people today who tried to post that narrative that Nancy Green was a grateful millionaire for being Aunt Jemima, therefore to get rid of Aunt Jemima is to be an affront to Nancy Green in her memory. We have to push back by the best way possible. Find the facts. Tell our friends the facts who are the most amenable to changing their minds. Start with that first and work our way toward the harder stuff. It's like this. Here's my analogy. You've chipped away ice in your driveway or sidewalk at least once in your life, haven't you, Bob?
Oh, and more than I care to count.
Now, when you do so, you know by now the best place to chip away at ice, it's not at the big, thick parts, right? Where do you start?
You start at the edges.
Edges. Work the edges. They chip away and they chip away. And eventually they're gone. And then the edges after that get thinner and thinner. We are you know what it is too? America's like a big friggin' high school. And we're it's a big, big high school full of who knows how many different cliques and how many clubs. But still, it's a high school in that a lot of people will go whichever way the crowd goes. And if they see enough of the popular kids are going toward favoring the work of Black Lives Matter or are against, you know, laws that discriminate against LGBTQ, they'll go along with it too because they don't want to appear out of touch. They want to be hanging at least close to the popular kids. This is America now, especially with social media. We all get right in touch with each other all the time. But what I keep trying to tell myself is don't don't engage with those who will just keep fucking with you. It's just a waste of time. It's not going to happen. But we all have those people. I had recently a friend who is a liberal, very, you know, liberal person, woman of around my age, maybe a little older. And she posted this thing about Oklahoma, you know, the upcoming Trump rally. And she reposted a thing that somebody, a white person, had written that said, you know, maybe the best thing to do is to not protest because that's what they want. You know, nobody should show up to protest the Trump rally. Everybody should just stay away so that Fox doesn't have a narrative to create from that. And at first I thought, well, that's kind of tactically kind of an interesting approach, and maybe that is something. And I went to her, you know, to see the comments, and all of the people agreed with her, and they were all white. And the person who wrote that post, original post, was white. So then I decided my only response could be this: but I wonder what a black person would say. And I think that's it. I think so many times, like right now, or when I, you know, I love to write the paragraphs, right? You know, I post in paragraphs all kinds of things that, you know, my own, what did you call it earlier? The filibuster. I do my own filibusters, usually on the page. I don't do a podcast like you. And, you know, I sometimes, maybe I just have to remember when it comes to these issues to always end my filibusters with the words, but I wonder what a black person would have to say about this. You know, the next time you want to watch Gone with the Wind, if you do, you know, every I'm not a racist has that one black friend. Well, why don't you invite that black friend
and just
over
have
to
a
watch
feeling
Gone
of
with
Gone
the
with the Wind? Yeah, make it a double feature and haul in Birth of a Nation while you're at it.
Well, 4 hours is enough for anybody. I mean,
well, that's true. It's a whole weekend.
Plus, Birth of a Nation is silent. I've been watching a lot of silent films, but lately. And even it tests my patience. But yeah, no, I'm serious. Let's work on the edges of those I'm not a racists. And if somebody calls us out on something, let's not be afraid to apologize for it and learn from it. And let's also just try to remember, we're, you know, in show business and in the film business, which I've worked for over 30 years, we have what's called a call sheet. Call sheet is like a schedule, a piece of paper, which has the scenes you're going to do the next day, what time to show up, and also what actors are going to be in those scenes. And it lists on the call sheet the list of all the actors who are going to play that day, and they each have numbers. And the star of the movie, Meryl Streep, will be number one on the call sheet. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 7 is like the guy that comes in for 2 or 3 scenes. 14 is the cop with the one line. So what I'm suggesting to white people is, remember, right now, when it comes to issues of racial conflict and so much of what's going on out there, you don't always have to be number one on the call sheet. Be number 7. Be number 14. That doesn't mean stand back and do nothing. Be a supporting player. Be a bit player. Listen for your cues. Remember your lines and listen for the other person. That was one of the things we learned when I was an actor.
Listen
to the other person's lines and react honestly off of that. That's all we have to do.
Yeah, there's a big difference between waiting to say your lines and listening to the other actor.
And you're a better actor
when you listen.
When you listen, it just comes out. Like even that thing of, well, how do you remember all those lines? Well, if you really listen, the line is natural, because usually another actor's line is either some form of a statement or some form of a question. Are you going to dinner with me this evening, dear? Why, golly, wife of mine, I forgot my cigarette lighter. I'll be back in a moment. That's your line. And if you just listen to her ask the question, you're going to tell her about the cigarette lighter.
You know, I have to depart for just a moment, and we promised we wouldn't do much of this.
Okay.
But I don't think I mentioned it to you. But I had a life changing experience doing that play down in Alabama. It was wonderful.
Uh huh.
And that is such a wonderful script, because you continue thinking about it long after the thing has closed, and with any theater piece. You come back and you go, oh man, if I'd only read it that way, ah shit. But there's the scene where Henry blows up and disinherits all his sons.
Mm-hmm.
And I got home from Alabama the last week of January. Got home on Sunday. I was sick by Monday, and I was dog sick for a week.
That. I remember that.
And I still don't know if maybe that's what that was. But by March, when things were shutting down and the numbers were beginning to climb and we were beginning to use the word plague, I in particular was using it, you know, as in avoid maggots like the plague because they are.
Mm-hmm.
I immediately flash back because it's the Henry character. You can wear the Henry character out just running around the stage and screaming for 2 hours. But he's no good he's no good that way.
Well, the play that you and I were in together at one time, The Trojan Women.
Yeah,
that had a physical effect on me. You had a real good part. You had a meaty part. I played just one of the soldiers. And my job was to stand on the stage
in the leather fetish armor. Yes,
in the leather jock strap with the leather Darth Vader helmet over my head, forming a human wall around the wailing, screeching Trojan women for 2 to 3 hours. And at the very end of the play, you, I believe, command us to take the Trojan women away. And the women we put them in chains, which are plastic, and we literally drag them off the stage. And one of the women, one of the actresses that I had to chain and take off the stage was extremely method. And every single night she fought me, like literally fought me, because her character's life was at stake. It wasn't stage fighting. She was whacking me. She was, you know, putting all her weight down.
She was living it. Yes.
She was living it. And so every night I would come off that stage, my knees, I'd have to get on my knees to finally get her to comply. Like I'd have to get down to her level. And like, I think, she, you know, whatever I had to do, my knees would be bloody and raw at the end. My elbows would be bleeding and I'd get bruises on my thighs and my stomach. I never complained about it cause I was pretty method too. You know, I mean, I did all kinds of nonsense in the interest of pursuing an art that I realized I wasn't as good at as other people. So, yeah, it does take a physical toll on you if you do a monologue, if you do, you know, all that stuff, screaming as you did for that part. You have to your body is your instrument. You're to some degree, you're like an athlete and you have to take care of the instrument.
The reason I brought up the Lion and Winter thing is when he's losing his shit on his sons and he's disinheriting them, he screams at them, "I wish you plague. May all your children breach and die." And I played it as best I could, and it was pretty powerful. But once the plague started running around the world and the country, I suddenly realized what a grave curse that was.
Oh yeah.
Holy shit.
There is no saving oneself from a plague. There's no escape hatch to that. Plague is final and definite. And it's like telling somebody to go to hell if you believe in hell.
Yeah.
I mean, it's as deep and as down as you could get.
And
you're wishing upon that.
And the idea that you would wish that upon your own children, you know, that's a fury that I don't think I've ever known. I have no sense memory for digging that up.
Mm-hmm.
But I mention all that because, you know, all of what we've been talking about is we must recall, Dan, taking place in front of a backdrop of goddamn plague.
This is a good place to transition into that. Yes, absolutely.
Sparky just sent me a news story. California's Governor Gavin Newsom, who is one of the most competent governors in the country as compared to, say, your Brian Kemp's and your Ron Monkey up DeKlantis's. He signed an order that says everybody in California going to wear a mask.
An order? Oh, wow. That's great. I mean, I know that they won't comply, but still just the symbolism of that is great.
Meanwhile, the governor of North Carolina, who's also a Democrat, is contemplating doing the same thing there. And lo and behold, what is the response of the maggots in North Carolina? Holy hell.
Of course.
There's a group of maggots there that call themselves Reopen North Carolina. You know, because they ain't got no freedom because they got to wear a mask.
Right.
Well, they're organizing mask burnings. I guess they're out of crosses.
Hmm. Well, as I said, Bob, it's so much of it just has to be about controlling the narrative, making sure that we've got data and truth on our side, and we're not going to stop maniacs like that. I mean, listen, Trump, if Trump were not Trump, all he would have had to say were three simple words: wear a mask. And suddenly to not wear a mask would have been an act of unpatriotic communism. But he wants to be the quote unquote tough guy. That is weak. And plus, of course, he wanted to, you know, his whole thing is re-election, you know, anointing of his kingdom. And it's always, of course, about him. And he's going to, you know, and his thing was like, well, I get reelected if the economy is good. So if COVID wipes out the economy, I don't get reelected. Therefore, there is no COVID. Bring on the Dow Jones. You know, we just have to keep doing what we do. And listen, too, in terms of physically, I'm still not going out there. Sorry, not going to do it.
Well, I wanted to get this down to the you know, ground level reality. And there's no one with as much at risk just based upon your own physical.
Well, there are plenty of people with risk and worse, but maybe personally, there's nobody you know with a greater risk.
That's right. And so I, you know, when you say what you're doing, I don't take that with a grain of salt. I take that as gospel truth from the cross.
Well, listen, when I'm done with you, I've been doing my walks now. You know, summer, it's hot, right? So first of all, I don't like to walk out in the hot anyway. I do 2 miles a day, or I try to. But summer is here, so kids are out. Kids don't understand social distancing. I get that. I don't excuse it. I understand it. I don't know how any parent right now with small children could do it. I pity any parent, no matter what, for that. But in my case, I'm not going out to do my 2 mile walk until it gets pretty dark. Because A, it's cooler, but more importantly, B, I got no kids around me to ride their bikes within a 6 foot distance of me, or to have balls bounce in my direction and yell, "Hey, can you get that?" No, I cannot. I'm not touching your ball. You know, I'm not that. Don't want to touch that joke either.
No, I'm just going to let that one hang up above the rim and bounce harmlessly to the floor.
But we just have to keep pushing back with facts and data to the people that may be on the fence. And you know, I've been doing more unfriending on Facebook than I used to do because I hit a wall that I realized even no matter my argumentative powers, I could not persuade. I had an old West Virginia high school fellow alumnus, class of 1982, who's totally in, not just MAGA, but she's into the deep shit stuff. She lives on some sort of religious compound, anti-vaxxing,
QAnon,
all of this stuff. And I realized after devoting like days to this stupid conversation, it's like, what am I doing? You know, it was interfering with my sleep. I'm trying to push a rock, which will not be moved. So you know what? Let her live her life. And you know what? Let her effing die. If she wants, if that's the cross she's willing to die on, that's the way I feel too about the upcoming rallies and the Republican convention. It's like, I used to be a lot more kumbaya about the whole thing, but you know what now? It's like, you want to kill yourself? I'm not going to necessarily applaud your killing yourself, but I'm not going to stop you from doing it either. You want freedom of choice? Here's your freedom of choice. You want to dive off the cliff with the king lemming? Go ahead and do it. I'm not stopping you. All I'm going to do when it comes back to the COVID thing, I'm going to stay in my house and I'm going to go out at 9 o'clock at night and I'm going to walk. That's when I'm going to walk. And I'm not going to grocery stores because I don't have to. And again, if you don't have a choice, I get that. And just everybody do your best. That's the thing, too. I'm not here to shame anybody because they don't live the Dan Fisher COVID-19 lifestyle. I know you all don't take immunosuppressants, and I do every day. But you all could get the virus, and you all know that. If you're listening to the show, I don't have to tell you that. So thank you for just doing your best. And always ask yourself, what could I do better? You know, maybe you should bring some vinyl gloves with you when you go out. You know, just have them in your pocket.
I glove up every trip. I mean, maybe it's
attaboy.
I don't think it's overkill, and that's a bad phrase anyway. I'm the one who, you know, because Agnes's immune system is compromised by lupus, and she's in a flare up right now, and because of an eye condition that she has, she can't take Plaquenil, which is chloroquine.
Yes,
because it could blind her.
Mm.
So she just has to ride with it, and she stays home, and I'm the one who goes and does, and I try to limit that as much as humanly possible. But when I go and do, I wash my hands before I leave, thoroughly, you know, the right way, singing, you know.
Prayer Jacques, whatever you want to do.
Yeah, whatever. Having dried my hands, I put on my gloves. With my clean gloves on, I put on my mask. Then I get in the car and I take a Clorox wipe and I wipe down the seat surfaces, I wipe down the dashboard, I wipe down the steering wheel, the latch to the door.
And then That is amazing.
And then I go and do what I'm doing. And you know, all of it doesn't add that much time to the trip.
It doesn't, and it doesn't impinge on your freedom either.
No, I don't. I'm not wanting for freedom. Because the thing that I'm most interested in is being free of that godforsaken killer virus.
Me too. I want to go back to work so bad. But
I have run into idiots. I mean, come on. I hate the stereotypes that get put out about places, about West Virginia.
Uh-huh.
You know, we can make fun of each other, but y'all can't make fun of us.
Right.
It's an unstated rule. You know, it's like the old gag about why can't you take a group picture of West Virginians? Every time the
I don't know, Bob. Why can't you take a picture of West Virginians?
Because every time the photographer says cheese, we form a single line.
I'm a picking.
And I'm a grinning. but I go in, like I said, I hate the stereotypes, but then I walk into the grocery store and it's wall to wall stereotypes.
Yeah.
I mean, big, obvious green arrows saying enter the aisle this way, and at the other end a sign that says do not enter, and I see my fellow West Virginians look down at that do not enter sign and go on by, and just go right on up the aisle toward me.
Well,
and it pisses me off.
If it's any small bit of comfort to you, my friend, know this, that I live in Rockland County, New York, 30 miles or so north of New York City. And I see all kinds of dunderheaded bullshit stuff by New Yorkers all around me. I live about a mile or so up from one of the state parks, Rockland Lake State Park. And they have, quote unquote, opened it up. And it's that scene from Jaws. It's July 4th weekend, and the mayor is saying, everybody come to Amity. And we're just putting chum in the water left and right. That poor Kittner boy ain't getting out of this one. I can tell you that much. And we have the outdoor hiking and biking equivalent of that just a mile and a half down the road from me. And I go into stores and – or I don't go into stores. I see people going into stores, I should say, without the masks, without gloves, you know, into small places, convenience stores. You can't even get 6 feet away from people in those places. But even the well-intentioned ones, and I guess this sort of goes back to my I'm not a racist's racist. I have well-intentioned friends. I did take the car recently to get the oil changed and a new inspection. I did that myself. And I dropped the car off, and there was Tony. Fantastic. We love Tony. And he's wearing a mask. Not wearing gloves, but he's wearing a mask. And he's in his office, little building, and I'm standing outside of the office waiting to come in. I'm waiting for him to tell me to come in. He's got like a little sort of customer desk, so I'm sort of waiting for him to go behind there so I can go in front of the customer desk, keep the distance, and get the hell out of there as quickly as possible with my mask and gloves. Tony is on the phone, and he has the mask. He's pulled it down so he can talk on the phone. Now, Tony talks on the phone a lot. He gets called left and right because he's an excellent car mechanic. So all throughout the day, he's interacted with people and touched that phone over and over again. And then when he's done on the phone, he greets me warmly and starts to walk toward me. And I literally back the F up the whole time, holding out my hand like Diana Ross in the Supremes. And I just say,
stop.
6 feet. I didn't say that, but I go, 6 feet, please. I mean, I sound like some sort of crazed librarian. I literally did that in that silly ass voice. I went, 6 feet, please. I went real high up in my register for some reason. And that stopped him. And then I realized, too, in backing up, there was a woman behind me. She sees me starting to encroach her space. She's not backing the hell up at all, and she ain't wearing a mask. So, West Virginians are very proud of their defiance of, you know, any government, whatever you want to call it, interference in their freedomness. And of course, we're all going to take their guns away someday. But it ain't all West Virginia. We know that, and that's the other lesson of social media.
But Dan, why can't they understand that the Rona is a hell of a lot more likely to take their guns away than the liberals is?
Well, Stacey Abrams talked a bit with Mark Maron on his podcast the other day that I listened to about that. We said, you know, this is also part of a growing mistrust of everything, that not just government, but just a growing public distrust of any information in general, that started from, you could say charitably, that started from the Vietnam War, when people started to figure out the government was lying to us. And then through Watergate, where we knew the president lied to us. And then through Ronald Reagan, the thing of, you know, government regulation, I should be able to drown it in the bathtub, and fake news. There's just become a suspicion of anything, of any authority or any kind of, and we're talking also knowledge. We're talking teachers, you know, colleges as a supposed, you know, harvest center for liberal thought, and, you know, the quote unquote liberal media. You know, it's just now to the point where we all get to decide what is information, what is truth. And also people are just intellectually lazy, and we do have a short attention span. So I think a lot of people just got bored of COVID.
Well,
you know, like, I'm just tired of this stuff.
I think people are. And like I was saying at the beginning of the program, things, you know, because we're trying to do it right, a lot of the things that I would do for relaxation or recreation are foreclosed. And so when we get days on end of shitty weather, it affects me. It affects my mental health.
Sure. It's like living in Scandinavia or something, right?
Well, I mean, it's monsoon season here again. You know, the entire spring was nothing but late February. I mean, it did nothing but rain. Then we got a couple of weeks of sunshine, and now we're back to, you know, I think there's a threat of seeing the sun here a week from tomorrow. And it's... And to that extent, you know, my pleasure has been taken out in, you know, cooking outside on my griddle and my smoker and mowing the grass and trying to tidy up a little bit. And it's all my fault because I mowed the grass and 5 minutes later it rained. As I've said, there is no more potent invocation of the rain gods than a middle-aged pink pasty white guy pushing a Husqvarna lawnmower.
Oh, I have the complete ability to control traffic, by the way. All I have to do is say the magic words, "We're making good time," and I instantly create a traffic jam in front of myself.
And yet you don't have the good sense never to say that. I mean, you and I are both fairly secular people, I think.
I thought you were going to say sexy, but okay.
No, that's a sentence. that's a sentence I will never utter.
Me neither, nor my udders.
But no, we're secular. And yet sometimes you just kind of have to look up and wonder if there isn't some other force at work. For instance, after my father passed away back in 2007, from that day to this, if I sit down to eat something that has a dribble factor, you know, something that's kind of sloppy or, you know, mustard out of a hot dog or a hamburger, if before I do that I say, "Hi, Dad," I don't get anything on my shirt. If I neglect to say hello to my father, I'll be wearing that fucking hot dog inside of 15 seconds.
Right.
I don't know how, but it just happens that way.
Well, that's what they call magical thinking, right? I mean, you could call it any number of things, but I know that magical thinking is a term for that. That if you say, hi, Dad, and listen, who's to say that you're not right? Maybe the magic is real, you know? That's the thing that I don't – I think I've told you I still – I don't know if I'll ever come to a decision about God, heaven, hell, all that. Right now, I don't believe in heaven and hell. Let me just put it that way. Or at least what we've been told – what I've been told my whole life what heaven and hell is, I don't buy for a second. But I could change my mind. And the thing is this, and people have told me when I've told them this, well, aren't you afraid when you die you might go to hell? It's like, well, you know what? All I can tell you is that if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. But I'm not going to fake it. I'm not going to consider God an insurance policy. If I'm going to love God, I got to love him. I can't just look at it as a stopgap because I don't want to suffer. But where this goes, I guess, is that, you know, I could be wrong. I could be wrong about all kinds of things. And I might not ever know, or I might find out. St. Peter might meet me at those gates that I used to mock and tell me that I had my chance and I blew it. I have to accept that. Or, you know, I see whatever, the Amish, the Hasidic, the whatever, the this. They might be right. They might be the ones, you know? We don't know.
Right,
we won't know.
But by definition,
we never know at all.
That means everybody else is wrong.
Right. Right.
Rowan Atkinson, you know, Mr. Bean.
Yes.
Had a sketch where one time where he appeared on stage in a red unitard with the pitchfork and horns and announced, by the way, you're all coming with me. Only one of them's right. It was the Mormons. And it got a huge laugh. But there's an element of truth in that. And I bring up the issue of faith just to transition us to another aspect of the COVID discussion. And that is the degree to which, and it's not just COVID, it is in our discussion of race as well.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the black church played a huge role in the civil rights struggle. It's
of course
undeniable. Dr. King was a pastor.
And then, of course, not just the Black Christian Church, Malcolm X and the Nation of Islam, you know, also right. had a huge, huge impact.
And so there's that aspect. But within the COVID era here in West Virginia and throughout the Southeast, largely African-American pastors have been dying in huge numbers. Because they refuse to acknowledge the reality of the disease.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think we can have a comprehensive discussion of how we got to where we are, Dan, without talking about the white church. Because the church in the South was not a redemptive force or a force for moral or social change. The white Christian church in the South was a tool of oppression. And the sad thing is it remains that in many instances to this day.
Mm-hmm.
There's a mega church in Atlanta that Brother Deacon Asa was telling me about or sent me a link to. And the mega church pastor's name is Louis Giglio, G-I-G-L-I-O.
And everywhere he goes, people. Okay, sorry.
Yeah, no, that's okay. I expected it. So he may, you know, he of course had to turn the video camera on, wherein he declared what he said was, "We understand the curse that was slavery, white people do, and we say that was bad. But we miss the blessing of slavery."
Oh, yeah, I read that one.
"That it actually built up the framework for the world that white people live in and lived in. And so a lot of people call this white privilege. And then you say those two words, just like a fuse, it goes off for a lot of white people because they don't want somebody telling them to check their privilege. And so I know that you and I both have struggled in these days with, hey, if the phrase is the trip up, let's get over the phrase and let's get down to the heart. Let's get down to what then? What do you want to call it? And I think maybe a great thing for me to call it is white blessing, that I'm living in the blessing of the curse."
Yeah, oh, and I think later he did one of those, I didn't mean to say it the way it came out, sort of right. Semi-apologies.
Yeah. Let me play the Nixon era non-apology apology. Yeah.
Right. But here's the thing too. Let me play sort of semi devil's advocate on this lunatic side for just a minute, because there's something kind of not wrong about what he's saying. Just hear me out. Hear me out. I'm not going crazy. In that what he's acknowledging in his own way is that there is white privilege and that we all benefit from it. I mean, the fact is this. Right now, we live in America, the greatest country in the world. But America was settled by, you know, colonialists. So the people who came in killed a bunch of people. America, we had the best, well, it was British people first. Of course, British people with the most advanced weapons in the world. And slavery was set up centuries before Declaration of Independence and, you know, all this stuff was ever even thought of. You know, this was a world that was created. America was created by the fact that we had people that had bigger and better guns and a willingness to use them than other people. And we took it by force. You know, the British Empire is the history of such things. So we live as beneficiaries of a system that we know now intellectually is evil. It's not just wrong. It was an evil system. You know, we can watch a movie like Stagecoach and acknowledge how great a movie it is. At the same time going, well, you know, just shooting Native Americans at will, that's not a good thing. And they weren't all bloodthirsty. They were, it was their land. And a bunch of people came and said, no, it's our land now. What are you going to do about it? You know, we got the guns. You want to try it? We'll kill you. And they did. We'll give you smallpox. And they did. So there's kind of, in a way, a not wrong thing about his extremely wrong thing. It acknowledges ham-handedly that we are all the beneficiaries of colonialism. And what are you going to do about it?
I think there's an element of truth to that. At the same time, however, Dan, I think the way that
it wasn't a blessing. Don't get me wrong.
No. What I'm saying though is he's willing to acknowledge it, but he doesn't seem to be willing to do anything about it.
Yep.
And the larger issue is that probably among the top three social constructs that are spreading this disease, fundamentalist evangelical Christianity is in the top three.
Oh, hell yeah. I mean, I don't know my history nearly as well as you, I'm sure, my history. And my daughter's a history major, so I could ask her, but she's down in her room right now. But, I mean, during the plague, wasn't that part of the schism too? Were the religious fanatics who just refused to acknowledge a plague existed in the first place? Am I crazy to believe that? Or I just think Monty Python.
No. What you had was there was no coordinated or coherent response to the bubonic plague.
That's a familiar refrain.
Hey, no kidding. the Pope at Avignon socially isolated and didn't get it, and mm-hmm. chalked it up to divine providence of, you know, the dear Lord Harry taking care of his popiness. But the fact of the matter was, he sat in a room that didn't have rats and fleas and didn't let anyone come near him.
Right.
That's how he didn't get the plague. But they couldn't draw the line between, connect those dots. And so somewhere between a third and a half of the population of Europe and Asia fucking died.
Right. When you know what, too, to connect a very long distant dot, it's not that kind of thinking is not far away from modern day white privilege, right? Or even economic privilege. This idea that, well, I did just fine and nobody gave me anything. Well, yeah, but look where you started out. You started out without the rats and the fleas. Some people do. Some people are born in a nest full of rats and fleas.
Well, right. And the Decameron, one of the great early pieces of Renaissance literature, is a story of tales told by wealthy people to pass the time while they were isolating from plague, because they had left the festering stews of the Italian city-states and gone out to live in the beautiful Italian countryside.
Sure.
And that
I read it. I'm waiting for the movie to come out starring Brad Pitt.
Yeah, right, necessarily.
As Joe Decameron,
and the funny character will be played by Steve Carell.
Sure.
Let me ask you one question as we're running out of time. But I wanted to, this was on my little list that, you know, I didn't tell you, but you worked on Mississippi Burning.
I did.
And I know that you are a stickler for as much accuracy as you can bring to your job. Did you delve deeply into that era as a result?
Dude, that was my job. My job, I got hired on Mississippi Burning originally as a 2-week job that turned into about a 6-month job. My job originally was to be the researcher for the art department, the production designer, to provide reference photos for the designer and the art director to look at and base their designs of the sets upon real life things. And this was 87 when I did this. Or no, it was 88. Winter of 87 into spring of 88, I did this job, and this was long, long before Google, of course. So what I had to do, I was working in New York City, which has a number of picture museums, photograph museums, and one, my mind is Swiss cheese these days. There's one up in Harlem, which is specifically about Black American history. I went up there. New York City Public Library has a number of photograph libraries where you literally go in and there's just it's like those old record stores, right? You go in and there's just these sort of rows and rows of thick piles of pictures, and you go through them and you just leaf through them, and they are organized, you know, by subject matter or time period. So there is something of a Dewey Decimal System. This is what I did for 2 weeks. Was just go through these. I would take the subway and go to different photo museums throughout Manhattan, Brooklyn, and Queens. This is work that took me 2 weeks that now would take me a day on Google. But at that time, you had to physically go to the places and check them out or Xerox them. So I created a number of files, and we even had like this file cabinet that we bought for the art department in the early stages when we were in pre-production in New York City. And then the production moved down to Jackson, Mississippi. And the art director liked me. So he asked production if they could spare the money to bring me down. And I was making, you know, far less than anybody else. I think I was making maybe $600 a week or something like $200 a day. And they also rented an apartment for me because it was cheaper than getting a hotel room for me. So I had my own little apartment in downtown Jackson, Mississippi. And my job continued to be to keep going through sources for photographs and information of that particular era and of that particular case, which was the Goodman Schwerner Cheney murders that happened in the summer of 1964, which was the year I happened to have been born. So I did this, and that became my job. And the file cabinet just kept filling up and filling up. And soon my assignments weren't just from the art department and design. Alan Parker, the director, and Peter Bijou, the director of photography, would come into the art department all the time, and they would want to look through the files that I had made. And so there are actual – I mean, listen, I didn't make Mississippi Burning, Alan Parker did, et cetera. But there is a small part of me in that movie, in that there are images and are sets that were directly created because of images that I found and I showed them. And they're like, yeah, that's what we want the church to look like. You know, it was a fictionalization of the Goodman Schwerner Cheney case. And it's a very controversial movie in that regard because it does set up the white FBI agents as the protagonists of the story.
White saviors.
Yeah. On the other hand, would the movie have been made, financed or made without that, without movie stars like Gene Hackman and Willem Dafoe? It would not have been made. It would not have been financed. Or if it had, it would have been done independently and gone into like 2 movie theaters across the United States. People did learn about Goodman Schwerner Cheney by going to the movie. It did win an Oscar. It got nominated for a bunch of stuff, including Best Picture. I have very mixed feelings about it. I'm proud of it, but I know it's problematic. And I know also that movie helped reopen the case and actually get one of the murderers convicted. You know, it was a cold case until witnesses started coming forward again as a direct result of that.
Was that Byron Della Beckwith?
Oh, golly. It's been a long time since I've done that kind of research. So that sounds familiar. could be right, could be wrong. I can't confirm that. But so research has always been important to me. That's really college, I kind of researched things, but it was on that movie that I started figuring out how much I enjoyed it and how to do it properly. You know, you just keep accumulating stuff and organizing it in a way that can be useful to you. And, of course, computers came along and made that a lot easier. Not just Google, but the fact that you can take all this information, create little files, and you know where to find it and you know where to reference
it. Send it around the world.
Yeah. The novel I'm doing my second draft on right now takes place in the 1970s. And even though I lived it, and some of it's based on my memories, the fact is, if I do look at a photograph of what, you know, my main street of my hometown looked like in 1972, or if I look at pictures of what of kids going to drive in a small town in Texas, that inspires me. And that gives me an idea for details that I can include in my story. So research is essential for all of that. And certainly those of us now who are trying to push back against those who are changing the narrative, whether it's COVID or the origins of Aunt Jemima, whatever it is, we just have to keep researching. And by God, you know, we've got so many resources at our disposal if we just are willing to do it and not afraid to express it, not afraid to tell the truth. You know, even if it loses us, quote unquote, friends, you know. I don't know about you, but I'm not going back to my high school reunion. I decided that. I love a lot of people I graduated with, but there are people I graduated with I don't want to ever be in a space with again for the rest of my life. I've seen too many horrible things they've posted. I know too much about them now because of social media. And I ain't going back there anymore. My dad's buried in the hills outside of town. I talk to him every now and then, but I don't need to go to the stone to do that.
That's a really touchy subject too. I mean, do you find yourself wondering how you became you while they became they?
I think I was always a they. I think, well, first of all, I moved there from the Pittsburgh area, and that's partly what my book is about. One of the characters is kind of me, but I have to stress it's fiction. And the more I've done the drafts, it's become more and more fiction. It's not memoir at all. It's people who are kind of like people I know, but fictionalized the hell out of. But anyway, there is a character that is kind of like a kid I was who moved there. And from the time I got there, I was told I wasn't, you know, I wasn't from there. I wasn't from there.
Plus,
I like to read. I did use words that big, quote unquote, big words. I got hit by people for using, quote unquote, big words because that meant I thought I was better than everybody else. You know, I never thought I was better.
We share that in common.
Yeah. I'm sure there are lots of yous and me's all around the world. You know, people who are bullied because they dare to just not be like everybody else. You know, whether that's because you read too much or you're not the proper skin color for the environment you're within. You know, whatever it is, you're gay and you don't care to hide it. You know, there are millions of us.
And by the way, I have to you reminded me of something. Herman wrote in a little bit ago, the black actor on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, Francois Clemens.
Thank you so much, Officer Clemens.
And he turned 75 this past April 23rd.
God bless you, Officer Clemens. God bless Fred Rogers, Joe Negri, all of them. Those people in Pittsburgh, they did it right. I'm as proud of Mr. Rogers as I am the Pittsburgh Steelers. In some ways, much more proud because, you know, Ben Roethlisberger, but that's another story.
Yep. Ben Roethlisberger?
Yeah,
I know.
That's another thing I've changed. But you know, listen, it's 8:03. I could tell you how I changed my views on that, but it's 8:03. So we should probably
look at us, and particularly, I mean, it's radio, but look at you. Had misgivings and nervousness, and dadgum if we didn't do it again, Dan.
I always come into this thinking, how are we going to fill 2 hours? And then at 8:03 or 8:10, there was one when Helene was on with me, we went into a third hour, went to a bonus hour.
Yep.
so we do it.
And we need to get Helene back, and please give her and your daughter and your son our fondest regards.
I sure will. Yeah.
Y'all are all incredibly special to us, and that's not blowing any smoke at anybody.
I'm sorry that we didn't get a chance to I don't know if anybody did email or message in. I'm sorry that we didn't get to present any voices other
well,
than our
I own. I did have one that I wanted there were a couple I thought we'd get to the end and I would just share things. When we were talking about how America got so damn stupid, and you cited, you know, the Vietnam War and the Kennedy assassination.
Right. A distrust of all information. Right.
Well, for your light reading pleasure, may I suggest that you lay hands on a piece by the political scientist Richard Hofstadter, and it's called "The Paranoid Style in American Politics," and it will put all of that in perspective for you. That's one.
Mm-hmm. That was recommended by a listener, or that's recommended
no, that's
by
me. That's me. That's me.
Okay.
Via Dr. Bill.
Oh, no.
A great place to see, and Angelo writes from the People's History of the Bronx, the People's Republic of the Bronx, a great place to see the history of Jim Crow images would be the Jim Crow Museum of Racist Memorabilia at Ferris State University.
I just linked them today.
And they've got a history of the Mammy character.
I just posted that today. I linked them and put a Facebook post about exactly that. And do you mind if I just take 5 more minutes to confess a sin to your listeners? Is that okay?
Mea culpa, tua culpa, tua maxima culpa. Go
right
ahead.
And it actually ties into previous discussion of Mississippi burning. When I was in Jackson, Mississippi, I was in a Stuckey's one time. And I was in my 20s, 22, you know. And they had like every mammy and step and fetch it type, you know, tchotchka you could imagine, shot glasses, salt and pepper shakers, cookie jars. They sold lawn ornaments in the restaurant. And I bought at that time a little 6-inch tall mammy figurine, brought it home, and it was on my shelf for a lot of years because I was into kitsch then, right? You know, I was into ironic things. I thought this was an ironic way of sort of expressing my feelings about, you know, racial divisions and whatnot, making fun of the Mississippians. But I realize now that was completely ass in the head wrong. I was wrong to do that, you know, just to give my money to Stuckey's, just to eat there, knowing, you know, to not see that stuff when I entered the restaurant and immediately turn around was wrong. And, you know, we keep growing, we keep learning. I was 22 then, you know, it's 34 years later. And I'm going to keep making mistakes, and I'm going to keep trying to learn, and thank you for giving me a chance to publicly confess a few of my sins here.
Well, I don't think it's so much confession as it is acknowledgement.
Yeah.
Because the problem with confession is that in its classical Roman Catholic form, you confess and you move on, and you do, you know, you mumble
five Hail Marys and a couple of Our Fathers.
Right. And you mumble it and you're done. And you don't really learn anything from it.
I only know this through Scorsese movies, so I might be wrong, yeah. But yes.
Angelo had a couple of books for you. One is Theodore Allen's The Invention of the White Race.
Mm-hmm.
And Nancy Eisenberg's White Trash, The 400-Year Untold History of Class in America.
Yeah, all of that stuff intersects, doesn't it? It's all part of the web.
Yeah,
spider web racism.
In a completely different context, as Tom Robbins once wrote, everything is part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, Jeremy in Vermont had a note for you saying, just in terms of terminology, as the son of a Jamaican immigrant who appears to be African American, honestly, he's Jamaican and part German. That being said, half of my family is of Jamaican descent and appear to be African-American. None of them like the terms colored person, person of color. It's always jarred me to hear it as well. My family prefers African-American or black.
Yeah, Jeremy, I understand that, and I apologize for that. The only thing I will say, and I don't mean to push back on you, is that I wanted to include in whatever sentence I used that in, I did want to include the notion that that whatever concept I was expressing at the time didn't just apply to black people. It applied to a lot of the disenfranchised by the system. Basically, everybody who's outside the white window looking in, I feel a kinship with you. I hope to express an allyship with you, and I'm gonna keep doing what I can in my limited way to help make things different and better.
And a conversation.
But I understand that
a conversation for another day. But it is one that should not be neglected or avoided. And I don't think it is being within the present space, Dan. Lou wrote a while back and said, what about Native Americans? When will their day come?
That's a good question.
It's not even so much a matter of a day, because I don't think a day has come in this current space. This is maybe the beginning of something we thought had begun a long time ago, but really didn't, because it's obvious by now, especially through what we know of policing, that a significant portion of society never took it seriously. It was, oh yeah, well, okay, you can, you know, as if the overt, grossest manifestations of it by having gone away somehow meant that the more deeper down internalizations had as well. So there's no more whites only lunch counters, and there's no separate drinking fountains. So that means it's over. That's facile. It is silly, wrong, just plain factually wrong.
Right. Yes, correct.
American public schools are more segregated now than any time since Brown versus Board of Education. And that's a fact. That's not subject to debate. And we are
the most incarcerated nation in the world. We put more people in jail than anybody, like percentage wise, not just numbers wise, percentage wise. And most of those people are young black men.
And there needs to be a discussion about indigenous people in this country.
Indigenous people in the world too. It's not just an American problem. Yeah. I mean, my kids both, you know, go to school in Canada, and you know, I learned of the problems in Canada with indigenous tribes.
Horrible. The shooting that took place in Albuquerque the other day was in relation to taking down a conquistador statue.
Mm.
Columbus was pulled down by young indigenous women in Minneapolis last week.
Well, this is indeed a whole other 2 hours down the line, right. And when I know more and feel qualified to talk more, I wouldn't mind at all talking about the problem of colonialism. I'm still learning a lot, from a lot of different sources and trying to get my head around something that I hadn't really even thought much about for most of my life. And all I can tell you is I'm trying.
Okay.
But I think that, in a future episode, we can go deeper into that. I'd love to.
Yeah.
Again, listen, I'd love for your listeners to call in during that segment and teach me a thing or two and bring their voices into it so that we can all be part of that discussion.
Very good. Very good. And I did get a note from Irish Dave. Please share this. The Jackson Advocate. You may have even run across some references to it during your Mississippi burning research. Flourishing amid fear, segregation, and mob violence, the Jackson Advocate emerged in 1938 as perhaps Mississippi's most successful, though ideologically conflicted, black newspaper. One of three black weeklies operating in the state at the end of the Great Depression, the Advocate campaigned vigorously for voting rights and education, yet secretly supported the caste system. Irish Dave writes, I met Charlie Tisdale around 1990 when he visited my black mother in 1978 after Green's death the preceding year. Alabama publisher Charles Tisdale purchased the paper and began deepening its racial consciousness. He appointed as editor Colia Lydell Lafayette, an activist, poet, actress, and teacher who turned the paper into a record of insight and inquiry. Tisdale risked his life by leading local marches against racial injustice. According to the black news website Mississippi Link, Tisdale viewed Green as a brilliant man who just didn't have any character. Fascinating stuff. So thank you, Dan.
It's history.
And it's
history you can't get on the side of a pancake syrup bottle, that's for sure.
Or in a meme about one.
Exactly. Or in a four-hour movie about the glorious Confederacy.
And the lost cause, right. And let me ask one thing, and then we're out of here. I know you're a little bit under the weather. Are you back up and full function?
Oh, yeah. Just in my particular case, when anything is not quite right, I got to lay low. And I laid low. And then yesterday, I've been fine. And then today, I felt like I had the energy to take you on for 2 hours.
Wonderful. Well, I'm glad to know it. You, like I said, you are often in our thoughts, and I look forward.
Vice versa.
I look forward to when we can be silly again. I do.
There will be a time. I don't know yet, and God knows, you know, I'm not Atlas with the weight of the world on my shoulders. I'm just not as silly as I might ordinarily be.
Understood.
But thank you for indulging me.
Enjoy your walk.
All right. Thank you. Love you.
Love you, man. Take care. Bye. That's my dear friend of long standing, Dan Fisher. And I look forward to every conversation we have, and I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did, even if the subject matter was difficult. Sometimes there is a certain pleasure that just comes from candid discourse. Shorty in L.A. says, great conversation, guys. Thank you, Shorty. Thank you kindly. And so we'll wrap this up this evening. Thank you again, Dan. And thanks to all of you who keep the program on the air with your kind contributions, your PayPal subscriptions, your Patreon subscriptions, your a la carte contributions, and combinations of all the above. Thank you for being one of the 1 in 100 people who listen to this program that help keep it on the air. We'll close the evening. We could get down to just having, we could actually finish Tuesday's fundraising with another $15. So that would be big, and that would leave us at $600 tomorrow. Thank you all. Thanks to those of you who share your precious finite time engaging in the program in whatever manner you so choose. Thank you to our all-volunteer staff. Thanks to Sparky in the chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas. Thank you, Brother Deacon Asa, HeadOn.live. Thank you, John Fox in Australia. Thank you, Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. 20-plus years at the forefront of the struggle for human rights and environmental justice in Appalachia. Remember, Malloy comes your way in about 44 minutes, right here on the HeadOn.live stream. Enjoy. I'm sure, I enjoy it. I know you do too. So thanks to Mike for letting us run the program. And always, Gina, it's all for you. Wash your hands, wear your gloves, don't touch your face, wear your mask, maintain social distancing, stay at home if you can, and at all costs, if you see someone wearing a red hat or a Trump t-shirt or anything at all Trumpy, or you saw their car and it's got a bumper sticker on it and they're coming anywhere near you, wherever you are, get as far away from them as you possibly can. Avoid them like the plague, because they are. Later, y'all.